Thanks for listening to WRIF Online. The live web stream will begin in 15 seconds.
This is Matt Demmer of Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury here to tell you about the exciting new Lincoln Mercury lineup. With the all-new Lincoln MKX, available all-wheel drive MKZ, or the newly designed Lincoln Navigator or Mercury Mariner, we have something for everyone. Stop in and see today. Jack Demmer Lincoln Mercury on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn.
Award-winning night call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for joining us this evening. And, of course, I am joined by Jalene Jordan. Hi, Jalene.
Hello, Peter. Good evening.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was thinking, we always start, and this is okay, but, you know, some people only hear different segments of any program, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Like somebody may be getting off work right now or coming home from something, so they always hear, like, say, 11 p.m. Eastern time till, like, 20 or like 10 after.
Sure.
So they're going to hear us talk about the fact that you were at a little concert with Kid Rock, right?
Oh, yeah. There was a special show that he put on at the Emerald Theater, Emerald Ballroom, on Thursday.
Yeah.
And I was right there in the middle of it. It was a great show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Where did I am always confused. What was it, he who was the had as a wife or companion, Pamela Anderson?
Yes, they got married all over the world. And now she just got married to someone else.
Some other rock
yesterday.
Guy. Where did I say? I can't
remember. He's the one who did the one she married was the one who did the sex tape with Paris Hilton.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's,
you can count on me for all the important information.
I knew there was some, yeah. But also, I guess they broke up. That's right. That they were viewing. What was the name of that film?
Borat.
Borat. Was that just the name of it? Just Borat?
Well, it was Borat the something.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So the first time that Kid Rock, he's married to Pamela Anderson, and there's a segment in there in Borat with Pamela Anderson. And so he just starts going off on her, right? Yelling at her, insulting her, until she's a fool. She's made a fool of himself, or made a fool of herself, and him as well.
Well, it was a volatile relationship.
I guess.
Yeah.
I guess. Well, in something a little more, I'm going to use this word, I have no idea what this even means, a little more prosaic. What the hell does that mean? A little more ordinary. I forgot. Anyway, so that's what I get for using words. I'm not even sure. I must have read it in the New York Times today or something, and I thought, boy, I can pose as one of those intellectuals, too. But a couple of very, very significant dates coming up, or actually, the significant date is October 9th, this Tuesday, and it marks the birth date of John Lennon.
Right.
And also the execution of Che Guevara in Bolivia. It's interesting. He said he'd never be taken prisoner, and he was, and then he was just summarily executed. They just, because they figure, it came from actually the president. I mean, there's some debate as to whether the CIA ordered him executed or whether the president of Bolivia. Now, at the time, Bolivia was run by these, what they called these cocaine, or maybe that was a little later. They had the cocaine colonels. In any event, it was a police state, a torture state, one of the types of Latin American governments that aren't around anymore, but prevailed in Central and South America in, well, God, for, you know, 50, 60, 70 years, because they carried out U.S. foreign policy, essentially, which was U.S. corporate policy. So when Che went, and essentially what was a fool's errand, but he had the sense that he didn't want to stay around in Cuba, that he wanted to make a worldwide revolution. So he went to Bolivia, where he thought conditions were the worst, and that they, you know, it was there that they could carry out a revolution. Well, it didn't work very well at all. So he was executed without a trial. It's not clear. What was his crime? I guess you could say insurrection against the Bolivian government, so which you would think would be a crime. Most governments make that a crime. And so rather than allow him to stand trial and to, as they said, make his trial a forum for his views, he was just shot in the back of the head.
Mm-hmm.
And so the debate remains, was it at the behest of the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency, which was all about tracking him down, or was it the Bolivian government? But how about this? The CIA instructed the Bolivian government. Right, I think that would make it. So there's celebrations in lots of places. You can imagine in Cuba tomorrow, Monday, there's going to be a ceremony at the tomb where his remains are kept beside a gigantic bronze statue built in his image in Santa Clara, where Guevara oversaw a decisive victory for the Cuban rebels. Cuba also planned a gathering of 1,500 people playing chess, which was Guevara's favorite game. Mm. In Bolivia, Che fans, what a weird thing to call them.
Right.
Fans. Che, what would be the word? People commemorating Che gathered in the jungle where he was captured in La Iquera, where and a new Che statue is being built in his native Argentina. Venezuela is holding an art and music festival in his honor, and students were painting huge Che portraits in Mexico City's subway.
I'm always amazed at all the kids, teenagers and young kids who are wearing T-shirts with his likeness on it.
Right-wingers have this one where there's an image of him with a slash across it.
Oh, that's original.
That's even cool. You know, it's like any publicity is good publicity as long as they show your face.
Or they say your name or whatever.
Right. Guevara's image is ubiquitous. It's everywhere in Cuba. It is indeed, where a giant stylized rendering of his face oversees Havana's Plaza of the Revolution, and they are the Cuban school children start their daily classes by pledging, "We will be like Che." Now, if you arrived in Cuba and went all through it and someone said to you, "Who is the current ruler of Cuba?" You would say, "Che," because there's like no portraits of Fidel at all.
Really?
Yeah, it's just all Che everywhere.
Well, I'm surprised by that a bit.
Yeah. It says, leftists still cherish the image. These folks are always about image. Leftists still cherish the image of Che wearing a beret.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beret, actually, but it's kind of cool to call it a beret. A determined gaze and an unkempt beard, but anti-communists hate what he stood for. One such man is Cuban exile and former CIA operative Gustavo Villaldo, now living in Florida, hopes to profit from a lock of hair snipped from the slain rebel's head in Bolivia.
Really?
These guys are so sick.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So they're going to have an auction in Dallas. Well, where else? The auction has generated much discussion among Cuban exiles. Some fear a Che fan will buy them and put them on reverent display. I don't know.
I still haven't seen that movie, The Motorcycle Diaries.
That's very cool.
Have you seen it? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, on the trip that I, and this was with, where was this? The man who they quoted, Alberto Granados, who traveled with Che across South America on a broken-down motorcycle in 1952, a trip portrayed in the 2004 hit movie, The Motorcycle Diaries, which was an excellent movie, I would suggest.
Yeah, I need to see that.
Yeah, and Granados is still alive, and remember, I took that trip to Cuba.
Yes.
And then, so I was there for a week in 2005, and then the organizers stayed on, and a new group of people came down, and they met with this Alberto Granados.
Oh, my gosh. Missed that part.
Yeah, I missed that. Right, okay. So, you sound like a commie. So, or maybe this does,
too. You get that every week. What do you mean?
I don't know, not lately. Yeah.
No?
And I always figure, yeah. But it's also the birthday of John Lennon, who would be 67, and Yoko Ono's unveiling this Imagine Peace Tower dedicated to John Lennon and his desire for world peace.
Where will that be?
In Reykjavik, Iceland.
Okay.
Yeah. You can, this is too hard. But if you just Google Imagine Peace Tower, Imagine Peace Tower, you will definitely show up with it.
Okay.
All right. There's another holiday on October 9th. Columbus Day, isn't it? Or is that tomorrow?
It's tomorrow.
Tomorrow. Okay. I knew it was right. I knew it was somewhere like that. Right. So, as I've done sometimes in the past, I'll tell you quickly why I will not celebrate Columbus Day. And
why I won't either.
What it marks, really. This is from page one of People's History of the United States, 1492 to the present.
Howard Zinn.
Yeah, you got. If you want to know about our history, you have to read Zinn.
And from the people's perspective, as the title says.
Right. So the first chapter is Columbus, the Indians, and Human Progress. And just a few lines from it. It says, here's how he starts. Arawak, who were the native people who discovered Columbus, Arawak men and women, naked, tawny, and full of wonder, emerged from their villages onto the island's beaches and swam out to get a closer look at the strange big boat. When Columbus and his sailors came ashore carrying swords, speaking oddly, the Arawaks ran to greet them, brought them food, water, and gifts. Columbus later wrote of this in his log. And here's this is Columbus. They brought us parrots and balls of cotton and spears and many other things, which they exchanged for glass beads and hawk's bells. They willingly traded everything they owned. They were well-built, with good bodies and handsome features. They did not bear arms, and do not know them, for I showed them a sword, and they took it by the edge and cut themselves out of ignorance. They have no iron. Their spears are made of cane. They would make fine servants. This is the first thing that Christopher Columbus says. Second thing is, with 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want. And I would say it's been downhill since then, folks. The Arawaks of the Bahama Islands were much like the Indians on the mainland, who were remarkable for their hospitality, their belief in sharing. These traits did not stand out in Europe of the Renaissance, dominated as it was by the religion of popes, the government of kings, the frenzy for money that marked Western civilization and its first messenger to the Americas, Christopher Columbus. Now, let me just give you a quick idea. By the 15th century, in Europe, there was an economic and political and cultural system that was nearing exhaustion and collapse. Economically, it was almost bankrupt. Remember, that's one of the reasons they were looking for all these new trade routes, and that's why they sent Columbus. It wasn't like the wonder of discovery or anything like that. They are, those of us who have European ancestry, came from a land that was in permanent depression. There were endless wars that just went on everywhere, all the time. Environmentally, our ancestors had destroyed the continent of Europe, had cut down almost every tree, because remember, that's everything they built and everything they used for fuel. That it was that the rivers were just swollen with human waste. It was terrible. Political absolutism, the rule of kings, there was some inkling of it maybe in democracy, or I'm sorry, of democracy in England, but not really. Religious insanity on every level, the Crusades, the Inquisitions, pogroms against Jews. I just don't even know how to describe it beyond that, other than religious insanity. And this wave of actual madness is that people reacted to this disintegration of the society of Europe in the 15th century by going quite mad, which gave rise to the religious insanity. There was also Europe in the 15th century marked by plagues, by the bubonic plague and smallpox and what have you. The cities were centers. We hear they had Cambridge University and all that, but mainly what was going on, these cities of Europe were these centers of filth and crime and degradation and these peasants that had their livelihood destroyed by enclosures and what have you had just streamed into these cities, making them unlivable. And, of course, much of it next to extraordinarily extravagant wealth as well. And there was a culture of intense cruelty. I mean, torture everywhere. Every state was a torture state. One of the biggest things of enjoyment was, animal fighting. They would set dogs on bears, dog fights, everything. It was a society in near collapse that it had to do something. It had a toxic culture, a toxic economic system. It was toxic environmentally. It was toxic politically. It was toxic religiously. So what did it do? It exported it. And it met the Arawaks. That was the first meeting of meeting the new world. And an inferior culture met a superior culture. And Columbus was too dumb to realize it. They were armored people. Our ancestors were, and much of that remains today, both physical armaments and also emotional armaments. The Arawaks, the other people, most of the people of the New World, knew how to live in terms of relationship to themselves and to the environment. And they lived mostly a life of joy, not this life of travail, this life of fear, this life of sickness, this life of religious fear, because, you may go to hell and all of that. And so the United States became an inheritor of all this, all, you know, all of Western, so all of these white settler colonial nations here, Canada, South Africa, Australia. And the first act was to dispossess the people of their land. And in the case of course, North America, it's this destruction of the population. So a genocide of almost 30 million people have taken place. And so it's a record of genocide, slavery of millions of people that were looted from Africa and brought here for the first accumulation of wealth, the looting of the gold from South America that actually then allowed Europe a new lease in life without ever dealing with and settling the inherent problems that remain to this day, and that this country is one of the biggest inheritors of. Now, why am I picking on us, my own country here? Because the other many of the countries of Europe began to deal with a lot of the problems, and when you think now that when you think of quite a good number of European countries, they're not racked with poverty and extravagant wealth, with endless wars, with religious insanity, with actual madness, with plagues and what have you. And also colonialism and imperialism, the desire to have an empire that stretches across the world. And when we look at what's happening all around the world, from Afghanistan to Iraq to South America, all of this is a result of that decision of Europeans to burst beyond their geography. I mean, what the hell are Europeans doing in North America? What are Europeans doing in South America? I mean, this is not where we came from. I know, we're here, right?
Yeah.
But and someone wrote me and said, you're so negative. Well, it doesn't get much more negative than this.
Yeah.
Because essentially what we're saying, the foundation of us being here, I'm saying, is corrupt, was the worst idea possible, that has extended the worst features of European culture for hundreds of years more. And who knows where this is all going to lead? Well, I think you got to figure out what in the world's going on and look at your origins and not celebrate it, not celebrate Columbus Day at all. I mean, I don't even think everybody's getting the day off, are they?
No.
No. I mean, at least we should have a day off, right? I think, what closes? Schools and banks and stuff like that?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about schools.
Business. Well, businesses,
I think,
don't.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Thank you for that history lesson.
Well, yeah.
You laid it out very well.
I don't know. I mean, I noticed, like, the phone lines are completely empty. People go, well, okay.
I think they're listening.
Yeah, well.
313-298-WRIF.
That's 313-298-9743. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And you can also go to myspace.com, Nightcall Detroit, and a lot of that will hook into Jalene's site as well. So give us a call if you'd like to. Am I being overly negative?
Will you be going to a parade?
Yeah. Is there? Oh, yeah, there are Columbus Day parades.
Yeah, big in New York there.
Yeah. Well, tomorrow, 5 o'clock, I'm going to be interviewing Pete Seeger. He's got a brand new documentary out called The Power of Song. And
I remember I called him once to book him for you.
Yeah.
And he was out in the middle of the woods, and I hung out, honestly, for 25 minutes, waited for him to get to the phone. He made it, though.
He's absolutely incredible.
And he said, why does he want to interview me? I'm just an old man.
Really? Oh, you did finally talk to
him? Yeah. He was fabulous.
Well, now he's got this documentary about him, and he's all ready to go. Bruce Springsteen, of course, did the Seeger sessions, which singing a lot of Pete Seeger's songs. And so, I don't know. I mean, I think Pete Seeger's probably 84, 85, maybe even 86. Well, all I got is, I'm looking around here. I'm trying to think, what do we have that's not negative? Nothing.
Well, that's what this show's about.
Yeah,
it's not about, marshmallows and puppy dogs.
No, it isn't. I could go for this, Us and Them. I was thinking about that.
For a Pink Floyd song?
Yeah, right. For us, the taxes are going up tomorrow, Monday. So we're wasting all this money all around the world.
It's a really nasty Monday already.
Yeah. And, it's Columbus Day, too. U.S. consumers are expected to pay record prices for heating oil, electricity, and propane to warm their homes this winter. And low-income families will need government help to cover those bills.
Good luck.
Yeah, they're not going to get it, right. Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and CITCO has programs that will help some of the poor, but the municipalities have to sign on for it. A lot of them refuse because they don't want, because Hugo Chavez is, what's wrong with him?
Well, I think he was being generous.
Yeah, right. He's
damn him.
CITCO, and that's positive. There's something positive. Hugo Chavez, contrary to all the oil companies in the world, which simply take this money and enrich a few stockholders or a royal family, is actually sharing this with the people of Venezuela and also when all over the Americas and including in the United States, where they have these programs to provide heating oil. And I think it's mostly heating oil for low-income families in Boston, in Queens. So he is – now, what's wrong with him?
He's a damn socialist, Pierre.
Yeah, right. So what do we care? That's socialist. So he's
that socialist is helping the poor of our country.
Yeah. No, I want to go buy ExxonMobil so I can help fund the ex-CEO's $44 million retirement fund. That's where I want my money to go. I don't want it to go any damn socialist.
You know what? There's a CITCO on by my house on one corner, and then across is a BP.
Yeah.
And it was, honestly, it was 12 cents cheaper at the CITCO. And I still see people going to that other station. I'm thinking, you are idiots.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, these right wingers have some boycott going against it, but I asked this guy, I said, do many, in a CITCO station up near my house, and I asked him, do you get any feeling people are boycotting you? He said, no, everybody in the neighborhood comes here. And it's always, I'd say the only thing wrong with that CITCO station by me, it's often hard to get in.
Oh, it is?
Yeah.
That's going to be my new station, you know.
Okay.
We'll be neighbors.
Yeah. Wow.
Wow.
There goes my property values.
Way up.
Okay. Here's Tim in Lincoln Park. Tim, it's Peter and Jillian. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Pete and Jillian. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Well, number one, I want to say Viva Evo. He's working hard down there trying to at least bring some democracy down in Bolivia.
Bolivia, yeah. Evo Morales. You like, and he's got a line of sweaters, too.
They sell them in the U.S.? They don't, do they?
No, you can get them online.
Well, anyway, I wanted to talk about how I first discovered all about Columbus, and it was, of all places, the Today Show. I was a recent high school graduate back in 85, and I turned on the Today Show just to, get me through the day to go to school after that. And this guy came out. It wasn't Howard Zinn, though. It was somebody else, and I can't remember his name, and he had written a book about Columbus.
Uh-huh.
And like everyone else, I mean, I had learned, Columbus, he was a relatively good guy. You know, he screwed up and so on, but, I mean, he was doing it for, queen and country and so on, even though he was Italian. But he, he sailed for Spain and so on. And, well, when he met the natives here, of course, they were all terrified and ran away. So, I mean, I totally believed that.
Uh-huh.
And I bought this guy's book, and it was like it was a paradigm shift. I mean, I completely began to question, how America was constructed, the myths we tell ourselves in the United States, the nature of capitalism. And it goes to show you, even if you watch television selectively, you can learn something,
Well, it's kind of like a raffle, though.
Yeah, it is.
Most of them don't get picked, right?
Yeah, well, five slept,
Yeah. All right, Tim, thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF.
My TV viewing, I stopped watching TV.
Yeah?
I'm done.
What about your 42-inch plasma? Are you moving that one?
I'm moving it, but it's only going to be for DVDs.
Yeah.
I got rid of my satellite. Peter, you should be really proud of me. My TiVo, gone.
Yeah.
Goodbye. Oh. Good riddance.
I'm trying to think if I've watched television recently. I was watching old Humphrey Bogart movies.
So. You like to watch Fox News.
Yeah.
When you go on vacation.
Yeah, I love to see. Isn't it weird that like this absolutely bizarre, over-the-top, angry Clarence Thomas, Justice of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
He writes this book. I mean, this guy got over on people. I mean, he was a mediocre jurist before he got on the court. It was the cynical nomination by Bush 1. They had agreed pretty much that there would be an African-American on the Supreme Court. And Thurgood Marshall, who had either retired or passed away, who was this giant in American legal matters, including all the civil rights stuff. So to to replace him, they take this guy who is this who's just this angry, mediocre lawyer who had a number of government jobs. And apparently, according to the testimony of people like, and I don't know if there was there more, but at least Anita Hill, that he had been involved in sexual harassment. Her story hung together then, hung and hangs together now. But it didn't wash with people, right? So he gets put on the Supreme Court. That's 16 years ago. And this guy brings it back up again.
Yeah, what was the story with that?
Yeah, I don't know. He's got this autobiography, and he's still angry. So where does he go to announce the story? He goes on Fox News, and he goes on the Rush Limbaugh show.
Oh, my God.
Now, any pretense that this man is making judicial decisions based on law and precedent rather than politics and ideology is completely gone. And he's talking about liberals and ultra leftists and stuff like that. So we have this mediocre ideologue, right wing ideologue, sitting on the court who never speaks. For one thing.
Except on Fox News.
Except on Fox News. Yeah, and I saw some little clip of him from ABC News, and he's just as angry as he always is. It's like, hey, Clarence, you won. You won. All right, you got over
Yeah,
on
you
people.
Got your big gig.
Yeah, yeah. You know, the Long Dong Silver movie that you were going to show, and the old pubic hair on the Coke can.
How
you
could
know?
We forget any of it?
Well, I'd forgotten all about it.
Not me.
Till he brought it back up again. What is with these guys? Well,
yeah. Wouldn't you want to put, you know, shove that under the rug if you were him?
You know, one of the things that when you listen to the so-called liberals on the Supreme Court, which aren't liberals at all, they're really centrist.
Yes.
Like Breyer and Ginsburg and, I can't remember, Souter, you never hear, I mean, they don't make speeches condemning conservatives or condemning right-wingers because, I mean, they have their opinions and they're called liberal, but they try to at least give the appearance
of neutrality or
neutrality,
better,
yeah. These guys, again, this other nutball, Scalia, another justice who, you know, similarly so far right wing that it's amazing that they're always out there making these political pronouncements and going on Fox News. All right, wait a minute. Let's talk to Kathy here from Ann Arbor. Kathy, it's Peter and Jillian. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I was just actually surprised because it seems so often I don't hear people make correlations between the history of this country and where we are today, and it kind of made me happy in a sick way to hear somebody else say that. I don't understand how people don't see that correlation so frequently.
This should make you happy in a good way, not a sick way.
Well,
happy.
Yeah,
celebrate.
Yeah, but I mean, and the thing, what you kind of perfectly touched on was that and the correlations are so strong between, like, the first and third world nations and their foundation and where they are today. And a lot of times people say, well, why are we over in Africa helping people out? And it's like, well, we have a lot to do with why they're where they're at.
Sure.
Today, you know, so.
Well, particularly with Africa, certainly more European colonialism that killed the different nations over there, killed millions of Africans, sold them into slavery. Different periods. I mean, I'm talking about the late 19th century when nice old Belgium ruled the Congo. It's called the Belgian Congo, and were responsible for what I think killing 2 million Congolese and. I mean, it is such a scandal, and the Britain dominating like Mesopotamia, which is now Iraq, and we go, oh, why are those countries so messed up, and why do they have such a bad legacy? Hello, it's because European nations were creating the context, just as you said, Kathy, for what we are looking at now, and we keep thinking. We take every incident, every war, every problem as though it just jumped out of nowhere, right?
Exactly. And another thing, going back to Africa and kind of relating with that, is like people don't, perhaps, what was it, 17 nations, I think, in the past 30 years got their independence. And, you know, it takes time. I mean, how long did it take the U.S.? How long were we a nation before we had the Civil War and we were still fighting over issues like that?
That's right. How many people died in the Civil War? Like 400,000 or something like that?
I think per capita it was the largest.
Could be.
Largest number of casualties for U.S. soldiers.
Kathy, are you familiar with a writer named David Barsamian?
No, I'm not.
Okay, he's coming to Ann Arbor on Wednesday. He's going to be in Detroit here at a couple of venues, at Wayne State University in the afternoon, and then in the evening at, it's on my website calendar, but at like 7:30 in Ferndale at a local church. And then he's going to be the next day in Ann Arbor. And I don't know how late you're going to stay up, but at 1 a.m. I'm going to be airing an interview I did with him earlier this week.
Okay.
But if you go, let me see, if you go to alternativeradio.org, alternativeradio.org, you can find out more about him and his latest book. All right, thanks for joining me.
Thank you.
Us. Appreciate it. I've been doing like 98% of the talking.
Well, that's usually not the case, but you had things to lay out, Peter. Yeah. You had things to lay out. We already discussed this.
If you want to find out more about David Barsamian, he was actually they didn't take me to task, but people for not being able to correctly pronounce names like Ahmadinejad and all that, and saying Iraq instead of Iraq.
That's right.
And I said Iraq. But
Iraq. I taught you that one.
You did. And Iran.
Right.
Yeah,
Iran.
But how about what's the president of Turkmenistan, Gurbanguly?
I have to have it in front of me.
Right. But and people say, well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how to pronounce Ahmadinejad or even Barsamian, right? But he said, well, we know how to pronounce French names and we know how to pronounce. But it's not always true. There's a lot of French names. French is difficult.
It is difficult.
Because you don't know, the endings are determined about, sometimes you leave off, like, if you're in France, like, there's, like, Café des Trois in a number of cities of France, because that means they're just by, like, a little body of water, a little strait is what it means, the strait. So you wouldn't, do you say, like the street here in Detroit, Livre Noir? Or is it?
Right.
It's certainly not Livre Noise.
To some
like
people, it is.
Yeah. Livre Noise. That sounds like an ailment.
I call it Livre Noir.
Livre Noir.
Yeah.
Livre Noir. Yeah. Yeah. Well, people. All right. We can keep talking about that, or we can do our spot and get back to you if you'd like to call up now. Now is the time. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. We'll be right back with more Night Call.
WRIF.com. We'll pay. hosting WRIF.com. On 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Angeline Jordan is back with us as well. And we have, let me see, our little drug segment here. The only program that dares to say war on drugs.
I can't even drive on drugs.
That's right. Well, get that. This is so incredible. I mean, these conservatives, and we're not talking about here. We're talking about our neighbors to the south, and I'm not talking about Mexico. I'm talking about Canada.
Huh?
You're saying, if you live in Detroit, you know what I'm talking about. But if you're listening around the country, around the world, you thought, aren't they north? No. Here, you actually go south to go to Windsor. But in any event, reversing earlier moves to decriminalize marijuana use. Remember, we reported that a couple of years ago or so, that the government was moving to decriminalize marijuana use. Gee, no longer are they going to bus people for smoking flowers and altering their consciousness. Because then they won't be ready to work and follow orders and what have you. All right. Anyway, this right-wing freak prime minister they got now, Stephen Harper, announced new legal and spending measures against drug use and distribution on Thursday. In 2005, the government, then led by the Liberal Party, wouldn't you know it, introduced legislation to eliminate criminal penalties for possessing small amounts of marijuana. Now, doesn't that make a lot of sense? The bill did not pass Parliament before the election that brought Harper and the Conservatives to power. It was never reintroduced. Now, Harper's got this minority government. Man, I can't understand. It's like Bush.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. He lost the popular election in 2000 and wound up, so he was a loser. He came in second, and he becomes the president. Harper said, far too long now in Canada, governments have been sending out mixed messages on drugs. Canadians hardly know what the law is anymore. To make it clear that drug use is illegal in Canada, he said the government would spend about, you ready for this, Canadians? $64 million on anti-drug campaigns and increased enforcement, including mandatory sentences for dealers and smugglers. There would also be, now this is ominous, increased coordination with the United States.
Yeah, go figure. Now, you can have small amounts. In Canada, can't you? Not
exactly.
At all?
Yeah, it's what you're saying. You're confused like Canadian.
I am. I thought Vancouver, you could,
You know, you spell Canada, right?
Oh, what are you, don't do this to me, what?
C-A-N-A-D-A?
Okay.
I wonder how many people don't get that at all, eh?
I think most people around here do, eh?
Yeah, they do. One time when my wife and I, we were traveling and... we got lost in Ontario, and this guy told us, he said, and this was years ago, so he said, you go to the 401A, so
we kept looking for the 401A.
Yeah.
Nice. You figured it out.
Yeah, sure. I figured it out. Yeah. Good. So, again, Canadians, just like Harper's wasting all your money on your army and also going to buy all these new ships to patrol the now-melted Arctic Sea, here's $64 million that could go into your health system, which needs funding, and instead going to spend $64 million on anti-drug campaigns and increased enforcement.
We're sorry.
So it takes your money, and you got two choices. Either it's going to give it to these big ad companies and the television networks and the cops, or increase mandatory sentences for you create a little prison industrial complex of your own, like sucks the money here in the U.S., or you can put it into the health system. So what do you want to do? Hey, Canada. Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. Our toll-free number is 313-298-WRIF. Right. And over in Afghanistan, which is still going to hell in a handbasket, after the biggest opium harvest in Afghanistan's history, American officials have renewed efforts to persuade the government here to begin spraying herbicide on opium poppies, and they found some supporters within President Hamid Karzai's administration. Karzai, though, has repeatedly declared his opposition to spraying the poppy fields, whether by crop dusting airplanes or by eradication teams on the ground. Now, the latter might put them in a world of trouble. This is a cash crop for these people. I mean, this is
huge,
absolutely huge. And by crop dusting, that means that this poison goes all over everything, including the beans and whatever else people grow there. So, the crop and the opium and heroin it produces have become a major source of revenue for the Taliban insurgency. Now, when the Taliban were in power, they had stopped poppy production completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Yeah. Well, okay, let's take some calls. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Okay. Here is Justin and Warren. Justin, hi. It's Peter and Jelaine.
Hi, Peter. How are you doing?
Doing great. Could you turn your radio completely off?
Yeah.
Good. Go ahead.
Going back to the Columbus thing,
yeah.
I completely agree with you on that we shouldn't celebrate it.
Okay.
Because, like, when you were in school, didn't they, like, tell you all the good things he did? Like, he discovered America?
Well, that was the only thing that was good. How come I keep hearing my voice echoing?
Do you have your radio turned down?
You'd have to, because we're on, like, a 30-second delay.
My radio's all the way down.
Okay. Mary. Go ahead. So, yeah.
Psychedelic, man.
The only thing that they ever talked about was the brave move of coming across the Atlantic in these little tubs. What was there? Three of them? Yeah. The Pinto, the
Santa Maria,
and something else.
The Nina.
Nina. Yeah, the little girl. Yeah. So that's right. Okay. Thank you very much. Let's go. All right. I knew that would flush out some Canadians. Here's Jay in Ontario. Jay, where are you calling from in Ontario?
I'm calling from Sarnia.
I know where Sarnia is. I was just there the other day.
Yeah, not a bad place.
Yeah, nice. Particularly if you're upwind of all the chemical plants.
Of Chemical Valley, exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So what's up? Do you think that the money ought to go for Harper wants to use against drugs or for your health system?
Oh, definitely I'd rather see look towards the health system, even though we do have a good health system already here in Canada. But one thing I wanted to mention on was you were talking about with marijuana and possession charges. I guess even though so much money is being spent on trying to battle the drug problem, still marijuana charges are far and few between.
No, that's
it's usually pretty they're pretty slack. A lot of small possession charges are just thrown out of court and not pursued.
Yeah, I asked a cop I know one time. I said, "Where do you get your reefer, man?" You know, because I thought it would be. Well, I knew he smoked,
so
I thought it was like pretty risky for him to go to some dealer. And he says, "No, I stop people, and they've got it, and
he's rotten.
Like, yeah, he just takes it, you know. I mean, in a sense, he does them a favor because like a non-smoker would probably just bust them, right?
Yeah, so he lets them go.
When I was a kid, we used to get stopped by these cops that would take our cigarettes away, And they'd say one would say, "Well, you gonna have my smokes tomorrow for me, Pete?" You know,
it's a racket.
I
find a rule of thumb by most of the cops in the Sarnia area. Anyway, use the 3-finger rule. So if they catch you with a bag that's less than 3 fingers in height, they just take it away and tell you to be on your way.
Well, it sounds like the same thing.
I heard
going.
That before, yeah.
3 fingers with the price of weed and how potent it is. That's a lot of reef.
Yeah, I would say that's about an ounce or so.
Yeah, wow.
And then yeah, I guess if anything more than that, then they're going to be probably charging you with trafficking or whatnot. Yeah.
Well, all right. Thanks for being the first person to make our show international.
Tonight.
All right.
Tonight, yeah. Thanks, Jay. Mm-hmm. All right. Bye-bye. Let's stick up in... However, the bad English. Let's stay in Canada, and also Mark's in Sarnia. Mark, hi. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi, Mark.
How are you?
Good.
I wanted to kind of touch on the reason why the whole decriminalization bill got thrown out.
Yeah, tell us.
It's mostly because the Liberals put it forward, and there was a tragic situation out in Alberta when... A guy, I'm not sure of his name right now, he had a grow operation in his house, and they found out about it. Not in his house, sorry, in a big shop.
Mm-hmm. He was growing it inside under lights.
Yeah, and there was a lot of pot there. And the Mounties came and raided it, and he had a rifle and shot the Mounties.
Oh.
He killed, there was about 3 or 4 of them.
He killed 3 or 4 of them?
Yes.
Wow. That's that's rude, to say the least.
And completely tragic. But...
Tragic is a better word for it, yeah.
Well, yeah. And
So, liberals...
So the one guy who killed the Mounties because he was growing weed ruined it for all the other growers.
So if it was legal... And including cultivation, like how do people get small amounts unless somebody's growing big amounts? If it was legal, you wouldn't face those kind of situations like that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's bad to say, but I think those brave officers would probably still be alive if marijuana was legal.
Right.
That's my opinion.
And the police only enforce laws that are on the books, the statutes that have been passed by the Parliament or the Congress. So if it is illegal and if growing large amounts is illegal, even under the new bill, they don't have much option. They're going to go enforce the law, which puts them in that position. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, all right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's take a little. This is interesting. This is Columbo from Columbus, who does not want to talk about Columbus. Right?
Hello, Columbo.
Columbo.
Yeah, that's me. My name's Columbo, and I never have Columbus Day off.
I mean, what?
That's... Yeah, no one does. Well, I mean, you should. Is that what you're saying? Because of your name?
No, it has nothing to do with it.
I don't get it.
I was going to say about the lead poisoning from China, painting the baby bibs with lead paint and all that kind of stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I heard even a mayor in Florida somewhere down there said it was trying to just boycott China and their lead poisoning. Maybe you could enlighten us on anti-China or boycott China.
Well, I don't think the United States is in any position to boycott China. They got us by the cojones, for one thing, because of the debt that we owe them. I mean, they're essentially Chinese banks and a number of other banks are keeping the United States economy afloat.
I think some people miss that whole point, too, Peter.
Yeah. And they because of working conditions and what have you, and lack safety conditions, I mean, they're worsening all around the world. They're worsening here in the United States. And all these departments that are suffering under Bush, with the product safety divisions and the consumer protection divisions, all of them are they've just devastated them in terms of career people, and just put these political flunkies of the right wing into these positions that will support the companies against our health and safety. So I don't know what. It used to be that you could buy American. Well, who was telling me something about, they were getting, someone who was driving a Ford was giving somebody driving a Toyota a hard time.
Yeah.
And he said, hey, your Ford was probably assembled in Canada or Mexico, and my Toyota was, it was
in Tennessee. Here,
in Tennessee, yeah. Go figure. All right, Columbo and Columbus, I'll see you. Well, these friends of mine were in Luxor, which is up the Nile River one time, and they were, far down from Cairo, or far, what would it be, up? Yeah, far up the river from Cairo. And they were in the city. You know, there's all these pyramids and other stuff
sure.
like that. And this guy
not
came
been
up,
there, but yeah.
Yeah, this guy right. came up to him and real friendly and said, Columbo, Columbo. And they said, yeah, Columbus, America. He said, yeah, Columbo, Columbo, come my house, Columbo, Columbo. So they go to his house, and what he's showing them on television are reruns of that old...
Oh, God. Oh, my.
And
very interesting. Go all the way over there to watch Columbo.
Yeah. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. Ooh, I haven't even looked at our email. It's calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And my website is peterwerbe, WERBE.com. And you can hook on both to the Night Call MySpace page and also to Jolene's.
That's right.
Do you have your new tattoos on there or just
not
the
yet?
Old?
Not the whole thing. I'm having a lot of work all the way down my
your
back.
Spine.
But down my spine. It's kanji. Everyone has a different meaning. I added compassion this week. I added a lot.
Isn't kanji a sort of a porridge?
I don't know.
What's kanji mean?
It's Japanese lettering.
Oh.
Yeah.
There is, I'm almost sure there's a Vietnamese kanji, which is a sort of porridge.
Okay. Well, I've never had it.
So, and you're confident that
yeah.
these people are telling you the symbols are correct, that they're not...
I've done my research. Peter, I'm your co-host and your
yeah,
producer.
You're
you
right.
should trust me more
I
than
do.
That.
I do. I was mostly being funny.
Yeah. You just want to see him again.
Right. The only place I've seen them is on
MySpace.
Your MySpace
that's
page.
Right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So wow.
You can see them on my slideshow, most of them.
What happened? Your site just crashed.
Mind it?
Yeah. So many people
oh,
just hit it.
Stop it.
All right. Here, I always like this. Here's Jerry in St. Clair Shores wants to recommend a book. Hey, Jerry, you're on the air with Peter and Jolene. Go ahead.
Yeah, Peter, I'm reading a book right now called The Shock Doctrine, The
oh,
Rise
yeah.
of Disaster Capitalism.
Extraordinary. Naomi Klein.
Yeah.
Oh, she's fabulous.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It reads like a roadmap to what's really happening now, and
yeah.
you can see the viciousness of behind these people and the way of and their thinking, what they've done in South America, in Chile, in the oddly enough September 11th, 1973, the military taken over.
Sure.
And it wasn't only a military takeover; it was corporatism, and they immediately slashed all government programs and privatized everything. And it absolutely destroyed the company.
Country.
Country, yeah. I'm sorry, country.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, this country is a big company.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and well,
bring it.
I think this book is important because I think it'll open people's eyes to what's actually going on here. They use the example of Hurricane Katrina. The hospitals and schools are wiped out, replaced by private schools.
And that's the Milton Friedman School of Shock
Chicago
Therapy.
Economics, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Yes. It's I can't recommend the book highly enough.
I'm trying to think. I thought it was somewhere on my website, but it's so labyrinthine. I can never.
It really is.
Yeah. It's a little. I got to clean it.
No, I think it's.
Yeah. There's surprises everywhere, even to me.
That's bad, Peter.
Yeah. Every once in a while, I kind of go through. Let me see. If this is now, All right. Yeah, I'm trying to get Naomi Klein as a guest on this program.
Oh, outstanding.
The interview segments. I've interviewed her before, and she's really risen in recent years as one of the most, what would you say, credible and...
Well, this is a very well-researched book. There's a
thanks
lot
for bailing me out. Yeah. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Usually that's me. But
yeah.
This appears to be a really well-researched book. There's a lot of footnotes and references that in the back of the book that all this stuff is verified and stuff like that. So it's not just somebody spouting off.
No, she certainly. I'm sorry. I'm looking at something on my...
focus.
Yeah,
focus.
I'm not focusing. But,
focus.
Yes, Naomi Klein, what's it called again? Shock therapy. No.
The shock doctrine. The rise of metabolism.
Yeah, yeah. Naomi Klein, K-L-E-I-N.
Yes.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. And I just learned in German what Klein means.
Okay.
And I can't
remember. Say it on the air?
Yeah, but it sort of surprised me. So we were talking about October 9th. Wow. This is Andy listening in Nashville.
Hello, Andy.
Yeah, and he says, I was born the day Che died.
Oh.
Wow. That's pretty incredible, I guess. And, you know. And what is this? There's another one from him. all right, never mind.
You better pre-read these things.
Yeah. All right. Are we on the air? Oh, yeah, all right. Yeah, we'll be right back. Peter and Jalene.
The lights up.
Looking out there.
The pictures.
The podcast.
The blog.
The special features you just can't get.
Anywhere else.
Super freaking cool.
Get them online at WRIF.com.
I salute yourself.
Or check us out at MySpace.com/WRIF.
Guaranteed to be extreme.
Because we can always use more friends, and we won't be naked.
Does anybody else smell Astroglide?
101.
WRIF.
People are sexy and clever, and they always say something funny right before. For a commercial break.
Everything that rocks.
This is WRIM.
We'll be right back.
Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome to our second hour. Jalene Jordan is with me. At 1 a.m., I'm going to be interviewing David Barsamian, who's the author of Targeting Iran, and he's going to be speaking in Detroit. 3 p.m. on the Wayne State University campus at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies in the Faculty Administration Building. Then 7:30 on Tuesday, he'll be at the First United Methodist Church, which is 9 1/2 in Woodward. Or, no, I'm sorry. What is it? Yeah, 8 1/2 in Woodward. 8 1/2 in Woodward. Right, south of south of 9 Mile Road. And David Barsamian will be talking essentially about his book, about how, I mean, in fact, his interview follows this show. It's absolutely extraordinary. I mean, the United States has a whole huge armada off the coast of Iran, which...
That's right.
Yeah, ready to strike.
Ready to roll.
Ready to roll. Then, let me see, this was... someone asked me to announce this. Man, do I get this wrong? Huh.
Hmm.
I'm going to have to work this
one
out.
Yeah, work this out later.
Yeah, yeah. Are we in the air?
Yes.
All right. But no, here. There's this Republican debate coming to Dearborn.
Ew.
Also on October 9th.
You mean the presidential candidates?
The presidential candidates, yeah. And CNBC is going to broadcast a two-hour debate beginning at 4 p.m. On October 9th. Well, a number of groups are going to be there protesting against all of these creatures that are these Republican candidates. So they're going to be there at 1 p.m. at the Ford Community and Performing Arts Center on Michigan Avenue in Dearborn, which, I don't know. I don't want to guess. I may be wrong about saying where that is. All right. Am I discombobulated tonight? I guess I am. Well, what happened to y'all?
No phone calls. This never happens.
313-298-WRIF. Did we knock them all? They were all, there was like six calls there.
Hmm.
It's completely open lines if you want to call.
Yeah, we can talk about anything that's on your mind. That's one thing that we always like to reiterate, that it's not just about what we are bringing to the table. We love it when the listeners bring things to the table as well.
Yeah. Steve writes in, because we were talking earlier about someone had written in and said that the show was always negative. And Steve writes
not
in.
Not always.
Well, that's
but
what.
They, considering who we are and what we're here for, well, there's. Absolutely. You're damn straight it's negative because we're complaining about all the negativity.
And that's what, it's essentially what Steve says. This is a conservative tactic. Shoot the messenger. They can cause all kinds of negativity, wars, corruption, scandals, environmental damage, stealing elections, etc. And the rest of us are just supposed to shut up. But once we raise our voices in protest, we become the evildoers just before reporting their negative actions. Look at General Petraeus, Steve said. It's okay for him to be a shill for Bush and his illegal war, but they claim MoveOn.org is in the wrong for pointing out the general who actually did betray the American people. He had an opportunity to tell the truth, but chose instead to perpetuate the problem, which will result in thousands of more deaths. But we're supposed to think that MoveOn is wrong. So don't apologize for pointing out their negativity. That's the first step towards stopping them.
Thank you very much.
This guy ought to have a talk show.
Yeah, really. And guess what? Now our lines are full.
Yeah. Right. So if you're ringing.
Easy peasy.
Yeah. You know what you got to do? Yeah. Put them all on hold. Yeah. There you
got
go.
Them.
All right.
We're there.
So, okay. So stay there, folks.
And we want to thank Jeremy for answering the phones. He's who you talk to when you call 313-298-WRIF or 9743. And also Al, our other producer who puts everything together for us in here, all the commercials, and we can't thank them enough.
I don't know if you saw any of this reporting. Some of it you did. Senator Wyde's stance.
I did see this. He vows to stay despite a court loss.
Yeah. He lost his court attempt to rescind his guilty plea in the men's room sex sting. He said, I think I've seen that it's possible for me to work here effectively.
Just keep the stance a little more narrow.
Yeah. But get this. Remember the male escort that was responsible for bringing down the Christian Avenue?
Haggard.
He said
that they did meth and did other things.
Right. Well, now he says that Senator Wyde's stance came to see him as well.
No!
It's really good.
Oh, how in the hell did I miss this one, Peter?
Well, it just came in. Just came in.
Oh, hot off the presses.
While promoting his new book during a radio interview with KNWQ in Palm Springs Wednesday night, Mike Jones said, let's see, where is this here? He said he was asked by Bulldog Bill Feingold whether the senator had seen Jones in a hotel room. Jones responded, "No, he came to see me." Jones then added, "His travel records in to Denver have been documented." That's what I wanted to say.
This guy's he's made the circuit of right-wing Republican homophobes.
But get this, the way he says it. Craig's office said in response, "Mike Jones's allegations are completely false." And then the next line says, "Christian evangelist Ted Haggard originally denied Jones' allegation of sexual relations in 2006. And these guys are such freaks. Listen to this one. Well, for one thing, I mean, that incredible case where that that Republican prosecutor from Florida committed suicide in this federal prison in Milan.
Right.
Yeah. That he was he came to Detroit. I don't know whether this was a national story or not, but he came to Detroit on an internet sting where he thought he was going to have sex with a 5-year-old. And so he got put in, he got arrested, and then he, you know, he was a pillar of his community, and, you know, he was a coach, probably, you know, like smacking kids on the ass and all
sicko.
That.
Sicko.
Yeah. Now, just another, it's just one after the other. Republican councilman in Louisiana, Joey DeFatta, who on Thursday withdrew from his Senate campaign, has been stopped twice since 1996 for suspicion of engaging in lewd behavior in public restrooms in Jefferson Parish.
Why do they call it lewd? Because it's, I mean, who's writing this stuff?
Yeah, no, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, guys can go.
They can do it wherever they want.
Yeah, well.
Well, I mean, you I know, mean, not, wanna, not like right in front of us.
Yeah, right. I mean, they ought to have a, like a designated stall.
They should. A sex stall.
A sex stall.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
Why stall sex? Have a sex stall.
That's pretty good.
Right.
You're so witty.
Oh, kanji is
K-A-N-J-I.
Oh, okay. The kanji that is the porridge. From Vietnam is C-O-N-G-E.
Okay.
C-O-N-G-E.
Is it good? Have you tried
I don't like it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's another one of these foot-tapping things with this Councilman DeFatta. But another Republican bites the dust. Just hours before the story appeared in the Times-Picayune, DeFatta called local reporters to announce that he would withdraw from the Senate race because he had been having chest pains and, quote, might have had a minor heart attack in the past few days. Now, these guys, all of them. This is not.
Why don't they just need to be free? Yeah, just be free.
Yeah. Why don't they do their thing?
How about do this? Go to a gay bar and find yourself something, and then take them home.
Why not?
I mean, just be free.
Now, how about this? This is so incredible. 20 years ago, televangelist Oral Roberts said he was reading a spy novel when God appeared to him and told him to raise $8 million for Roberts University, or else. He would be, quote, called home.
We were on the air. Remember this?
So he's reading a spy novel. I mean, he's reading Le Carre or something, or what's some of these other people?
I know none of them.
And God says, Oral, you will. You know, I mean, now his son, who is Anal Roberts. Oh, no, no.
Wait, no, that's not it.
Richard. Sorry. So God is
You're
speaking again,
me.
Telling him to deny lurid allegations in a lawsuit that threatens to engulf this 44-year-old Bible Belt college in scandal. Do you have this?
I have it right in front of me.
You could pick up. Then.
Well, he says he is accused of illegal involvement in a local political campaign and lavish spending at donors' expense, including numerous home remodeling projects, use of the university jet for his daughter's senior trip to the Bahamas, and a red Mercedes convertible and a Lexus SUV for his wife, Lindsay.
She's accused of dropping tens of thousands of dollars on clothes, awarding non-academic scholarship to friends of her children, and sending scores of text messages on university-issued cell phones to people described in the lawsuit as underage males? What? Oh, so there is a little sexual connection here.
Well, go figure. And of course, at his chapel service, one of many, I'm sure, that he does per week. We live in a litigious society, he says. Anyone can get mad and file a lawsuit against another person, whether they have a legitimate case or not. Well, he's right about that. But this lawsuit, he says, is about intimidation, blackmail, and extortion. How about it's the fact that you're guilty? Hey, allegedly.
You know, you actually read over this too quickly. You didn't read it entirely correctly.
Oh.
That's not what Anal what's his name? Richard Roberts said. He said God told him we live in a litigious society.
Oh, yes. I missed that little big part.
Now, can you imagine
God
this?
God told him.
God is telling.
You know, even when I was
Anal
a Christian,
Roberts,
Peter, God didn't tell me anything.
Yeah. I mean, I'm here. I mean, I'm willing to meet anybody.
Right.
Yeah. Come on down.
Come on.
Yeah. So they're.
We need some proof.
Yeah.
Should we go back to that
amputee
argument?
Yeah. How come God will not cure amputees?
Yeah. There's one. We'll throw that out there.
Right.
We haven't thrown that out there in a while. It's so outrageous.
Now our phones are filled, and Adam from Romulus is going to tell us about kanji, the symbols.
The porridge. Oh, the symbols. Okay.
Not the porridge.
Yes. The symbols. Yeah, let me keep this really quick here. Kanji is actually, it is Japanese, but what it is, it's a Chinese symbol, but it's the Japanese word, different pronunciation, but kanji means the same thing in Chinese as it does in Japanese, because before Japan had its own written language, it used Chinese symbols. Japanese, though, actually uses a syllabary, sort of like our alphabet, if you know what a syllabary is.
Nope. But go ahead.
Basically, imagine if our alphabet was made up of syllables instead of single letters.
Right, gotcha.
That's the normal way Japanese people write, but before they developed that writing style, they used Chinese characters. So kanji is actually a Chinese character.
Right. Which is why I'm getting the sign of the dragon below all of this, because that's my sign.
That's
my astrological Chinese.
Lots of people tend to have problems later on with anything in Chinese or Japanese, so I hope these are really good friends of yours who are giving you these tattoos.
Well, you know, I don't care what anyone thinks. I like what it is, and it's for my own personal strength, but I hear what you're saying.
Did you bring in the characters and have them copy them?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
you go.
Yeah.
All right. So that seems to be safe.
Yeah.
All right, Adam. Thank you very much.
It makes me happy.
It.
Thank you, though, Adam.
Next time, there's this wonderful Tai Chi teacher in New York who's native Chinese, but his name is Ed Young. He's an illustrator of children's books.
Okay.
Or just incredible. And he lectures on Chinese pictographs.
Oh, so maybe next time he's in town, I should bring my back and show him?
Yeah. He'll go, oh.
This actually means.
Yeah. But he, you know, they're little pictures in a way. In many words has heart in the middle of it. And in fact, I'll show you. I got a poster that we have at our house.
I'm sure I've seen it already.
Yeah. It's in my bedroom.
Oh, well, maybe not.
Maybe not. Okay.
Yeah.
Boy, everybody wants to talk about such interesting things.
Well, this is good. Let's go.
All right. Let's try Tony in Waterford. Tony, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hey.
Hi.
Peter and Jolene.
Tony.
I've been a long-time listener, Peter, and I agree with most of your viewpoints. I think I'm a progressive person, and I just have a suggestion. This is made in all sincerity. I think that your ultimate goal of a more fair and just society and a more open and caring society would be better achieved if you were to cut back a little bit on the tone of the language that you're choosing to use when talking about people such as Oral Roberts or Larry Craig or people that are on the extreme right.
You mean don't call them right-wing psycho freaks?
Well, exactly.
Come on now. We have every right to.
Yes, you do. I agree. You do have the right to do that. I'm not disputing your right.
You're
to
saying
that.
I'd be more effective.
Okay. We've heard this a few times.
What they call ad hominem arguments. In other words, you attack the man rather than his arguments or his political positions.
Exactly. And try to reduce the name calling.
You know what? Every once in a while, I try.
We try.
But
we do.
I just can't help myself.
We do try.
I know you try. I'm just suggesting that you try to be a little bit more conscious of it.
Well, let me tell you this, Tony. Actually, I don't try, and I do this very purposely. And to some extent, I can. Like, for instance, if you listen to National Public Radio with this very measured discourse and what have you, and it sort of gives each side, allegedly, it doesn't really turn out like this because there's a large preponderance, even on NPR, of conservative male politicians, white male politicians, and what have you. But I mean, it's part. Someone said also wrote that I was using shtick, you know. Which and talk radio is a lot more like that, for instance, than just some of these talking head shows. So you know, over the years, and Jalene is right that some people have said, "Oh, you know, why do you talk so disrespectfully?" Mm-hmm. Or why, you know, like when we were doing this national show in 2000, that we only referred to Bush as the loser because he had
the resident
rather than the president, and they said you know, you're using the same kind of language they do. Well, I don't know, I can't help it. I can't. But I mean, all right, let me just say this.
Should we try to do it for like 5 minutes?
Yes,
or at
right.
a time.
Okay, thank you, Tony.
Baby right. steps.
How can we? All right. Senator Larry Craig, Senator from Idaho, said today, what a right-wing freak, hypocrite.
Wait, I'm yawning.
Yeah,
that sounds so boring.
Doesn't it sound more fun to call him Senator Widestance?
Yes!
You know, let me just go back to why we call him Senator Wire. Does everybody know? He said that he wasn't tapping the cop's toe in the stall. But
trying to get some action.
He said, yeah, trying to get some action. He said, I'll take a wide stance.
He will remain Senator Wide Stance no matter what.
I guess so. Here's Roman and Alan Park. Roman, and hi. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air with Peter and Jalene. Go ahead.
Hi, Peter. I wanted to speak about the Iraq war, but never mind that. On some of the topics you touched upon, I think, to put it bluntly, I think our young people are really getting ripped off by everything that's going on. You know, let me give you an example.
Sure.
When I was 12 years old, I had a teacher named Mr. Baker. And this guy used to hold clothing drive committees. It was only like for boys and that. And we'd go out and get clothes, you know, for the needy and that.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy would take us up to his cottage in Pinckney, you know, and for a weekend. We had the greatest time with this man, you know. Nobody was molested. And I think reaffirmed, you know, like the male bonding type of thing and being with your best friends and that. And, you know, today, he was a bachelor, mind you. But in today's world, if a man did such a thing, you imagine what would happen to this poor guy?
Yeah. I mean, how about what's that guy, Mr. Roberts?
Was Mr. Rogers?
Mr. Rogers, yeah. I never.
Mr. Rogers.
Yeah, I mean, you know, what was this guy doing, having these kids over his house all the time?
I mean,
the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah.
what was that called? I can't remember. That's Disney.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, Jody, welcome to the show. I've never spoken to you. I've been a long-time listener since...
Oh, thank you.
I'm 51 years old, and I was a teenager when I started listening probably to this. But
the show's been on a long time.
Yeah.
Yes, it has. You know, I've met you at Wayne State a few times, Peter, and I find you very interesting.
Well, thank you.
But, you know, it's just like, all in all, I think, God, don't you think our young people are missing out? Like, my daughter was a Girl Scout, and they asked me, I was laid off from my former occupation, and I went to college. I went to Wayne State for the paramedic program and that.
Mm-hmm.
Worked Detroit for 3 years. And, you know, when they asked me to go up north with them, I refused. You know, it's just the stigma attached to it, you know. Like, for instance, I just redid my paramedic thing. And in the Arabic community, there's such... I mean, I respect their beliefs, you know, and their religious beliefs and that. But as a medic, you have a duty to act, you know, once you're on the call.
Yeah.
And you would want to be helped, you know. But it's just a simple thing like me examining the cranium of a young female. I might as well grab, you know, the private parts. Because I'm not kidding. This is the way it's going to be deemed. And that's the way I'm going to be charged, you know. And it's like, this society has to come to some kind of, you know, understanding. It's like...
Well, let me just say, I know exactly where you're coming from. My wife and my dog and I, we walk through the neighborhood. Sometimes we'll see a little kid, and the kid will say, can I pet your doggy? You know, all that. We stop and talk. And sometimes she and I walk and, you know, say hello to people and all that. When I'm walking by myself, I won't even say hello to a kid.
No?
No. I mean...
You would, let alone examine his cranium.
Right. All right. Thank you, Roman.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Roman, I was just being silly.
Yeah. How about this? Roderick writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Mm-hmm. I've got a clothing style for Senator Wide Stance. I think he should wear very baggy clothes like rappers. That way he can have all the extra space for his legs to stretch out wherever he desires, and he can be cool, too.
You put a lot of thought into that. Thank you, Roderick.
Yeah.
Oh, I think we've hit a new low.
Yeah, we have.
Yeah.
Here's Kevin in Livonia. Kevin, hi. It's Peter and Jolene.
What's up, Peter and Jolene?
We're
Kevin.
Just doing the show, Kevin. Yeah.
Hey, you know, I'm the singer and founder of Poker Face, and I don't know if I've talked about my band at all, but...
I've talked to you about it before.
Yeah, we're doing the token this Friday, and we don't get a lot of publicity.
Okay.
Yeah, usually we charge for this.
You guys do any political content?
No, we're political. It's all the same thing.
Well, everything is political.
Hey,
I think brushing your teeth is political.
Kevin, do you have a CD out?
We have a MySpace, but right, it got messed with, and the new one that you go to is Detroit Rock City's Best Kept Secret.
All right, well, you know, we have the Motor City Riffs show here on WRIF.
Yeah, and also you should go to the Night Call with Peter and Jolene MySpace, and you can go to mine, Jolene Jordan Music, and you can find it. Let's be friends,
yeah.
Poker Face.
Well, it's just tough getting to computers. I don't actually own one.
My okay.
Now go down to the library.
Have a good show at the token.
When is the token?
Friday night.
All right.
Thursday nights. It's an open jam with my band members, Tim Krukowski from Sponge and Mike Adkins from the Flophouse Band. They do an open mic night at the token as well. So there's a little more publicity for my friends and the Token Lounge.
All right. Thanks, Kevin. Rock out with Detroit Rock and Roll. Speaking of Detroit Rock and Roll, in fact, someone wrote in, which seems to have totally disappeared here, but was asking about the John Sinclair.
The documentary that you went to Saturday night, last night.
Yeah,
20 to Life.
He says, Steve writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com, I missed the premiere of 20 to Life here in Flint. I heard you tell John Sinclair you would be attending another showing. I was wondering where and when that was.
Last night.
Well, it was last night, yeah. I'm really glad you guys are still netcasting your station. We mean what?
Well,
streaming?
The podcast, probably. Yeah, he probably does mean listening, streaming live at WRIF.com.
But we get up to Flint, don't we? Yeah, the signal does.
I don't know.
It's only 60 miles.
Right, you would think.
Anyway, the next showing of it, although you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com, and click on the calendar right on the left there. It's kind of the scene of the city, and that'll show you where the Ann Arbor showing is.
Oh, so maybe you could head out to that one.
Yeah. Indeed.
And you enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was really good. And I swore I was going to party with John later and go down to the Butcher's Inn and the Eastern Market. Just folded him in early.
Yeah. Well, some nights you got to do it. I didn't.
No. Okay. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Mike in Lincoln Park. Hi, Mike. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wanting to talk about a little something more local.
Sure, please.
The ignorance of our manufacturing force, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, what's left of it.
Right. Well, I had the chance to, you know, I'm another one of the people that had a plant closing, but I've been able to stay with the corporation and move to different areas,
mm-hmm.
sister plants and stuff.
Okay.
And talking to the people that are just so anti-union, they complain about their working conditions, but then they on the other hand, complain about unions and people making $30 an hour sitting on their butt, you know?
Well, they always talk about sitting on their butt. How do they get any cars out? I mean, this, you know, I've said so many times before, this country is run on what I call the politics of resentment. And the fact that people have united together to get a fair wage and good working conditions and what used to be guaranteed pensions and medical care when you finally put in 30 years of work on that in production line, they resent that. I mean, you get people that are making $9 an hour complaining about unions rather than saying, I got to join one, too. I've been a union man all my working life.
I would be if I could also.
I know. Well, actually, Mike, you may be glad to know that when they do these polls, the majority of people, the majority of working people would like to belong to unions. Because, I mean, every statistic shows if you belong to a union, the union workers versus non-union workers, you get more pay, better working conditions, and better benefits. So what kind of person would not want to have that? The only problem is that unions have been just getting slugged so badly because of the globalization of the economy. And what's got to happen? There has to be an international union movement. Sort of like the 1930s were here for the United States, there has to be that for the entire world, because these guys are they're working our brothers and sisters around the world to death at slave wages, and it's driving down our wages and closing plants, right?
Right. Well, I feel like I'm in the middle of it. I'm 43 years old, and I'm in a generation that grew up for people that fought that fight. And we just were born into it. You know, we don't realize what it took to get what we were born into.
Yeah.
And as a generation, we're letting it all go because we just don't know any better.
Well, it's hard, too. I mean, it's just like in any fight. Sometimes one side has the advantage and sometimes the other does. So like the 30s through the 50s, even into the 60s, labor had a great advantage. But when suddenly the companies understood that they could drive down the cost of their labor by first going to the American South, beginning of the 1950s, and then to Mexico, like beginning of the 60s, and finally, you know, places like China and Vietnam and what have you, that also eroded our wage structure, and that they could blackmail us because they could say, hey, either you got to accept crappy wages or we're just going to leave Michigan. So people, the ignorant people blame unions for fighting for their members' rights to have a decent wage. After you work all day in an industrial plant, you should be coming home with lots of money.
Long enough to support your family, anyway.
Well, yeah. I don't mean millions, but I mean not $9 an hour like Delphi wants to cut it to a worker's wages.
Exactly.
Now, the UAW, talking about how it's saving jobs, here's according to this account here, General Motors plans to close as many as 13 factories, four more than it previously announced. Hey, Ron Gettelfinger, president of the UAW, I thought you said that this labor agreement with GM was going to save all these jobs.
Right, and you know, people just don't understand that the main thing that unions stood for was outsourcing, and what has destroyed our country since is outsourcing.
Yeah, I mean, it stood against outsourcing.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry if I'm
Right. Right. Well, no, I knew what you meant.
We know what you meant.
Yeah. Well,
but, I just wanted to bring that home a little bit because I'm like putting up this big fight with everybody I work with, and it's like, well, why don't you see this? I don't understand where your belief comes from, you know? And
yeah.
You have any suggestions for him, Peter?
Well, no. I mean, it's tough right now. I mean, certainly the ability to. I mean, there's not new. Well, there are some dynamic unions that are trying to do more about organizing. In my union, even the American Federation of Television and Radio Artists are saying, "Look, either we've got to get a lot of new members, or we ain't gonna have a union."
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're yeah. dropping members in with an incredible rate. And the difference between, in this broadcast industry, between unionized work and non-unionized work is startling. But as it turns out, GM's going to close their engine plant in Livonia.
Mm.
There's a couple thousand jobs or something.
Yeah.
But we got to look for it all to turn around, Mike. I don't know what it's going to take or, you know, what I usually say. Either we got to fight back or we might as well all
I say we
organize the Mexicans.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't know. I don't understand that. I mean, I don't know enough as much as I should about the international labor movement, because why isn't the UAW, for instance, which used to be called, may still be, but it was called the International United Auto Workers, because at that time when it was formed, it included Canadian workers as well before they broke off and just was the CAW, the Canadian Auto Workers, and that they ought to be sending organizers rather than into the Toyota and Honda plants where they keep losing these elections. They ought to send them to Matamoros, and where these guys are producing cars for like $3 an hour. All right, thank you. Appreciate it, Mike. You're right. Either we should fight back or just thatch our roofs and admit we're peasants. All right, Peter and Jolene, 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
Right back.
This is WRIF.com. WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment. Jolene Jordan with me. Talking about name-calling, which we were calling, I didn't know this. Joe writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He's that caller earlier, remember, who was Tony, who was saying don't...
we need to maybe not do so much name-calling.
Even Jay Leno calls this Senator Larry Craig Senator Widestance.
All right, so there.
Yeah, but... You know,
we're supposed to be more evolved than Jay Leno, though, Peter.
Exactly, exactly.
We're sorry. Let's can't promise that we will be.
Well, here's David is listening in Walla Walla, Washington.
Ah,
streaming.
Welcome.
Says, really like your broadcast. Been listening for a long time and think you're right on it. And you and Jolene are a good match.
Ah, we think so too. Thank you.
did I do
somewhere along the line, Peter decided that was true as well.
Yes. Frank writes in, hi, Peter and Jolene. When the North American Union hits the news, it'll be too late and people will be passive resistors to a chip implant Bush approved. The North American Union, this is making a lot through the internet if you haven't seen this, supposedly the three North American countries, of which Mexico is one, right? Right, it's North American, the United States and Canada. Well, I know you'll probably think I'm part of the conspiracy, but it ain't going to happen. And it's not even in the cards. So don't worry. There are a lot of things to worry about. The North American Union is not one of them. Nobody would go for it. Nobody would go for it at all. All right. Here is Aaron in Southgate. Aaron, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air. Hi.
Hey, what's going on?
Hi.
I need to bring up the whole trust with teenagers right now as my big issue. I'm 18, you know, trying to start doing my own thing, and I recently started getting a new girlfriend, and my biggest problem is that my mom doesn't trust me to be in at a certain time.
Yeah.
You know, it sounds kind of ridiculous, but, you know, that's what I'm dealing with.
Well, yeah, you know what, I could maybe expand upon that a little bit in that, yeah, it's treating people your age as human beings,
yeah,
right? And maybe giving you a chance to prove that you're trustworthy, right?
On the other hand, Aaron, you're 18 years old, so
and
you're
you have
an
a
adult.
New girlfriend. Huh?
Yeah, 18 is a legal adult, right?
Yes.
And my entire family refuses to agree with that.
Hmm. Well, I would say continue to prove yourself to them. And how could they deny it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the one good thing you could do, right?
Yeah.
Well, part of the problem is, of course, and it's difficult these days. You're living at home, and are you contributing at all, or are you going to school? Or?
Oh, yes. I'm attending college, and, you know, I'm trying to get my own job and help out, but, I mean, it's still...
Now, you are 18. Maybe you should stand up for yourself a little more.
Yeah.
With respect to your parents.
But you can get a lot of that as long as you're living under my roof and I'm paying the bills,
right,
young man.
Yeah.
So there is that aspect. One of the things about adulthood is independence, and it's hard. I mean, we know a lot of young people, because of the economic situation these days and the high cost of everything, they can't afford to. When I was a kid, you know, when I was 18, 19 years old, man, you just go out and get an apartment. I don't even want to tell you how.
17, I got my own.
You did?
Yeah. I graduated from high school early.
And did your parents trust you?
Hell no, they didn't trust me, but they also weren't. They couldn't keep... How could they stop me from going to college?
There you go. Yeah, I loved it when I went to college.
I loved
it.
Are you kidding me?
I went wild.
I did too.
I went wild.
Cut all my hair off. Woo!
Cut it all off.
Yeah.
I grew it all along.
Well, it was a different time.
Yeah,
I was in the punk rock era.
Oh, I see. All right, thank you very much. Maybe other people will have some comment, Aaron. Thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Let me just go back a little bit, too. I never finished this. Us and them. Us, our taxes are going up today, Monday, state taxes. And also, I said earlier that we're going to be paying record prices for paying heating oil, for heating oil, electricity, and propane.
This winter.
Yeah. Now, there's always a sort of a missing referent there. That is to say, who are we paying it to? Right?
Yeah, good question.
So you and I are paying record heating oil, electricity, and propane prices, but it's going to somebody. And it's not like their costs may be going up some, but it's also that their profits expand enormously. And so what does that mean? They're gouging us. They're looting us. So every time we turn around, gasoline's going up. Now all these heating systems have to go up. And how about this? Oil prices could top $100 a barrel by the end of next year and remain above that point for years to come.
I remember when it was, 40?
25. During Clinton years.
Yeah.
And it's just one thing after another. Remember that Bush was saying he didn't want no socialized medicine. He didn't want the government taking over, so he got this drug program for seniors.
Mm-hmm.
These are our parents, our grandparents. Sometimes they're us.
Was only helping about 5,000 people? Was that the one?
About 5,000 insurance companies.
Oh.
Yeah, no,
maybe this is something different I'm thinking of.
But tens of thousands of Medicare recipients have been victims of deceptive sales tactics and had claims improperly denied by private insurers that run the system's huge new drug benefit program and offer other private insurance options encouraged by the Bush racket. Or it says Bush administration here. All right. The problems described in 91 audit reports reviewed by the New York Times include the improper termination of coverage for people with HIV and AIDS, huge backlogs of claims and complaints, and how about this one? The failure to answer telephone calls from consumers, doctors, and drugstores.
Mm-hmm.
You ever tried to call some of these places and you get put on hold endlessly?
Yeah.
So they've got hundreds of callers calling in, and they maybe have like six incoming lines because they just count on that you're not going to be patient enough to stay there.
Yeah.
I mean, credit cards, one of the things that they do, every once in a while, they'll just decide they're going to assess everybody $75.
Yes, right.
And if you're maxed out to like $8,000, what's the average credit card debt, like $9,000 or something like that? And another $75, what the hell?
Yeah.
But so you go, wait a minute, what the hell did this $75 come from? So you call and they say, you know,
administrative costs or, right?
Well, they don't say anything because you've got to wait like 25 minutes on hold before you'll even reach anybody.
Right.
And they're counting and that most people are just going to hang up. So Medicare officials have required insurance companies of all sizes to fix the violations by adopting what they call corrective action plans. And since March, Medicare has fined these companies $770,000. This is 11 companies for marketing violations and failure to provide timely notice to beneficiaries about changes in costs and benefits. Now, here is the line that is really important. The companies include three of the largest participants in the Medicare market, UnitedHealth, Humana, and WellPoint.
Okay.
Excuse me. What's the operative word here? Market. Market. We're getting sick, and they look at it as a market. Well, what do they want to do in any market? You want to drive your costs down. So on one hand, we were just talking about unions and unionization. The companies want to drive down their labor costs. Doesn't matter what the hell happens to us or our families or our communities. They want low labor costs. They want to purchase our labor at the lowest price imaginable. That's why the industrial workers of the world, the IWW, go to IWW.org, the first line of the Constitution says the working class and the employing class have nothing in common. Now, we, the workers, often stupidly think that there is a commonality of interest. The employers know absolutely that there is none whatsoever. I don't mean to say there's not generous employers.
Sure.
And, I mean, in fact, some of these companies like Myers and Costco, mm-hmm. they actually encourage unionization, and they're okay with their unions. But in the main, it's a matter of profiting to the largest extent possible, whatever it does to the people that are working their butts off for you. So here, where we're talking about our health, and not just our health, this is our senior citizens. In every culture that had that was worthwhile, that was a worthy culture, takes care of its seniors, its elders. Forget about seniors. Even that kind of has tell me if I'm wrong, a senior has a sort of negative connotation. I like the old word, elders.
Yeah,
the elders
I like
of
that
our
too.
Society. The elders are here, screw you. You know, pension, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
Yeah. You worked at GM, or you worked for an for some white collar job, and you expected some guaranteed pension and health plan. Ha 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 ha.
Right.
Yeah. Because
the joke's on you.
Yeah, the joke's on you. We just can't afford it anymore. But they can afford, even at a bankrupt company like Delphi, they can afford hundreds of millions of dollars of bonuses for these guys, or the Michigan legislators. They. They're taxing us more, and have they taken a hit on any of their salaries or their benefits or their pensions? Well, do we even have to
answer that? Yeah. Right.
No. So as long as health is considered a market, as long as it's privatized, we're going to come up with a short.
It's so far gone, too, Peter. That's the huge frustration. It's so far out of control.
The audits document widespread violations of patient rights and consumer protection standards. Some violations directly affect the health of patients, for example, by delaying access to urgently needed medications.
Nice.
I just saw this movie. What a companion piece to Sicko with Damon. What's his last name?
Matt Damon?
Matt Damon, yeah. It was, oh boy, I'm forgetting everything. A famous writer, a lawyer that usually...
You're not going to get me. I won't be able to answer this one. Usually I'm your wing girl with the pop culture, but I can't.
What's that Matt Damon film? It was done about 10 years ago. It's set, I think, in Louisiana.
Was that with, he was with Robin Williams?
No. Okay. You're thinking of...
See, that's the only one. I can't even think of that one.
Good Will Hunting.
Oh, yeah, right.
Where they get in an argument. Robin Williams, who's a shrink, isn't he? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Matt Damon is this math genius, and they're arguing who's more important, Howard Zinn or Noam Chomsky.
And you know why? Because Matt Damon lived next door, grew up next door to Howard Zinn.
That's right.
Yeah.
And Mrs. Zinn.
I didn't know that.
Made cookies for him.
Aw. Oh, isn't that nice? Mrs. Zinn.
Here's Mike in Sterling Heights. Mike, hi. It's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. Hi. I've been listening for... forever. I remember the old days, Sheila Rush Lowe. I love Night Call.
Wow, you're way back.
Yeah. I like to know how she's doing, but anyway, you've changed your format. You have a co-host now.
Yeah.
Hi.
Yeah. It's kind of Howard Sternish. Somebody to agree and laugh with you.
Are you saying that's good or bad?
It's not good.
do you want me to have her spank me? Would you?
Howard Sternish, and I just want to know.
Jolene is probably being insulted. I'm thinking this could mean a lot of money. Will you spank me?
Jeez, Peter. Do you want me to confirm what this guy's sitting here talking about?
I'm just thinking.
Okay, it's not like we have any nude women in the studio. It's not like we're doing any sexual weirdness in here. It's just what it is.
Think about we could be millionaires.
We could if we did some spanking.
Yeah,
you know?
There you go.
Yeah,
we got to. You could. What he was doing.
Make
was,
fun of people who have mental disabilities.
Does he do that?
Yeah. So okay, we don't do that. There's another thing we don't do.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. I was actually listening one time when he had some dominatrix or what's the other word?
Dominatrix.
Dominatrix spanking him. He had him tied up and they were spanking his bare butt. And his on-air partner, Robin Quivers, he was yelling, and it sounded, he could really hear this whacking. And he was screaming, and he said, Robin, stop her. And she said, give him hell.
Nice.
All right, thanks a lot.
Robin Quivers, I'm not.
Wait a minute. Where are you? You're not even here anymore. All right. In a way, that's kind of sexist. If you laugh and,
that is kind of sexist. I'm kind of mad right now.
Yeah, I don't blame you.
Yeah, thank you.
I don't blame you.
Thanks, Peter.
Right. Okay.
I'll get over it really fast, though. That's the good news.
All right. We got maybe time for a couple more calls. 313-298-WRIF. Right. A caller called in and said the film with Matt Damon is called The Rainmaker.
Oh, well, yeah, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. There was another film with Dustin Hoffman called Rainmaker.
Rain Man.
Oh, yeah, it was Rain Man. That's right. Rain Man. That's right, because that was what he called him. His name was Raymond, and he called him Rain Man. But,
right.
The Rain Man, The Rainmaker was a very, very good film, but he didn't tell us who had written the book. Man, I can just see the guy's name almost. He writes all these kind of legal fiction books or things that have court settings. And
let's just not sit here and do this.
Begins with an L?
Let's not do this.
All right. Someone call and tell us.
Yeah.
Here's Jeff from Detroit. Jeff, hi. You're on the air. Hey, Jeff.
Yeah?
Yeah, you're on the air. Hey.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
You got to help me, Peter.
Yeah.
How do you keep from becoming a cynic? You know, with all that's going on in the world today, and you hear people that, you know, that get caught doing things, deny, and then you find out it's true, you know, like the evangelist a while back and Marion Jones recently. And with all the scandals going on in the world, like Blackwater and all this, how do you keep from just losing all faith in mankind and just saying, you know, I'm going to do whatever I can get away with?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Cynic is the... I'm not cynical. I often get very, very pessimistic. I mean, the whole human race may have dug ourselves into a hole because of our numbers and because of our impact on the planet and because of the economic and political system that rules the world. it's very possible that it could be curtains for us. I mean, we're in a privileged sector of the planet, and of course, also one of its worst abusers. But I don't know. I mean, I guess you have to
stay focused. And
I don't even know.
Stay... Throw yourself into political action.
Well, you can get cynical
about
that. That's
what you always suggest to me.
Yeah, but you can always say, I mean, wouldn't you agree, Jeff, that you can say, well, political action, and we've done everything. We've got the Bush barely is at 30% popularity, and these maniacs just continue this war and probably will even bomb Iran, right?
Well, you know, mostly I think that a lot of people are just walking around with their heads in the clouds. You know, I mean, we have all kinds of news going on, like the uprising in Myanmar or Burma. And yet what makes the news is, you know, they're talking about Britney Spears losing custody of her children.
Exactly.
Right. Or whether Barack Obama is wearing a flag and a little flag pin on his lapel.
You know, you say, because I remember when Bush started, he went, you know, when they hit the towers.
Yeah.
And he said, I'm going into Afghanistan. I said, okay, I can buy that. But then somewhere along the line, he starts talking about Saddam Hussein. And I'm saying, what does Saddam Hussein got to do with the towers? And then, you know, then they're talking about we're going to invade. And I'm saying, why?
Well,
and then still people just, you know, like marched in line with it and went on in there. And I remember at work telling the coworker, I said, you know, they're not going to find any weapons of mass destruction unless Bush has them shipped over there.
Well, let me tell you this, Jeff. I'm going to cut you a little short because we're almost out of time. So much of that, we were talking about history, and Jillian and I often talk about Howard Zinn's book about people's history of the United States. History for most Americans is about a week. So when we're talking about something that happened 6 years ago, I mean, how does the United States, how does Bush, how does Petraeus, how does anybody have the right to complain about anything that's happening in Iraq? We invaded the country illegally. The people that promoted this were lying. They're now making up lies about Iran, getting ready for another battle over there. They've got this $600 million embassy that came out of our tax dollars.
In Iraq,
yeah. That is the largest in the world. So obviously the United States is planning to stay there for a long time. And you don't need, just for diplomatic relations, you don't need a $600 million embassy. It's all about oil. It's all about having bases. And I think people get cynical because they say these elites, these undemocratic elites that control the entire world, are impervious to popular control. All right, thank you, Jeff. That's an excellent thing to break up. Do we have...
Yeah, good that you were right there when it was happening. You figured it out.
Here's Matt from Detroit. Matt, just a minute or so left. Hey, Matt.
Oh, hey. Thank you, Peter and Jillian.
Sure.
I just had a question. If you could recommend a good book to read up more on Bush Co. and find out how Bush and some of his cronies started really coming to power.
Well, you know, there's lots of stuff out there. Let me, I don't know, all of a sudden there are so many that come and gone.
Do you have computer access?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
You know what?
How about on your website, Peter?
Yeah, I was going to say, do this. Email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I wish you would have done this, and I'm not faulting you for this, would have done this about an hour ago. We would have had 45 calls. This book that, and I've forgotten her the name of it, this Naomi Klein book, is it called... Yeah, I'll find this all out for you. My brain is ready to go to sleep, I think.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, man.
Thank you very
much. Email me, and I will definitely get back to you on this. Let me see how many. All right, we do have time for exactly one more call. Chris, hi, you're our last caller. You got to do it real quick. Oh, wait a minute, I got to get Chris on the air. Sorry, Chris, go ahead, you're on the air.
I mean, what can we do to, you know, show our disgust to what's going on about the Michigan taxes and everything that's going up?
I don't know. And I know that that's not what talk show hosts are supposed to say. We're supposed to be these know-it-alls that know-it-all. Well, I have to say, I don't know at all, and I'm pretty stumped. I mean, we're taught that all problems have a resolution. And yet we're at a point where the what to do is not exactly apparent. I mean, Jolene was right. I mean, involvement, and sometimes people say, what the hell do I be involved in? I mean, I can go vote for somebody, but that's just this passive act. How do I get involved, like, tomorrow? What do I do to make some of these things happen? Well, and there are things happening, and you have to be alert. Some of them, as Jolene said, are on my website. Others of them are, you know, present themselves in different ways. But you, at this point, you have to really make an effort. And unfortunately, I can't make an effort any longer because we've got to end the show right now. So it's a great question,
yeah.
And that's another one that I think that if would have been asked earlier, we could have gotten a lot of response.
There's always next week, Peter.
Yes. Thank you, Jolene.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. David Barsamian is our first interviewer and interviewee, and then after that, it's somebody else.
Guaranteed to be entertaining.
Yes. Robert Frank. Oh, this is good. Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class.
Mm.
Thank you, and we'll talk again next week.
You're listening to WRIF.com. On 101 WRIF Detroit, here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you, and it's a pleasure to bring back to the microphones on the Peter Werby Show, David Barsamian. David Barsamian is the award-winning founder and director of Alternative Radio. It's the independent weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado. He's a radio producer, journalist, author, and lecturer. He's been working in radio for almost 30 years. His interviews and articles appear regularly in the Progressive and Z Magazine. He has done numerous interviews with Noam Chomsky and has a brand new book out called Targeting Iran. David Barsamian, welcome back to the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks a lot, Peter. Always a pleasure to be with you.
And you're going to be here in Detroit. We'll give that information a little later. If you're not with us a little later, you can go to my website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. Also to David's site, alternativeradio.org. Tell us some about your book. We've talked with a number of people about targeting Iran, and the opinion is rather mixed. I would say that most people are leaning towards there will not be an attack on Iran. What say you and the others in your brand new book?
Well, logic dictates that the U.S. would not take military action against Iran for the very reasons that rational people give. The U.S. is already engaged in two major wars. The Army, the National Guard, the reserves are all overextended. They're exhausted. The Army, according to General Colin Powell, is almost broken. Equipment is being rapidly used up because of the severe weather conditions in Afghanistan and Iraq. And those are all the logical reasons. But I believe an attack is more imminent than most people anticipate because the Bush administration is now scapegoating the calamity in Iraq and increasingly blaming things that are going wrong in Afghanistan on Iran.
Mm-hmm.
And Iran is being demonized. You see the reception that Ahmadinejad got in New York, for example. You know, the evil has landed,
right.
One of the headlines screamed. Well, all of that reporting, including the hate monger Glenn Beck on CNN, that's Glenn with two N's, who is openly comparing Ahmadinejad to Adolf Hitler and Iran to Nazi Germany, echoing the very words of Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel's Likud party, incidentally. These people are so off the mark, they don't even know the basics of the Iranian political structure. Ahmadinejad is not the top banana in Iran. The top banana, the man who decides all national and international policies, is the supreme leader, and he can trump anything that Ahmadinejad, decides on. So there's a basic, a disconnect there in the media reporting, that comparing Ahmadinejad to Hitler and that he's omnipotent and omniscient in some way.
David Barsamian, tell me, it is disturbing to see the level to which evil is assigned to Ahmadinejad, President Ahmadinejad. Certainly he has said some outrageous things. Certainly that there's not the kind of democracy in Iran that that we would favor. And the triumph of theocracy there is something I'm uncomfortable with. But it's disturbing when a major anchor of a network station, Kathy Couric, can't even pronounce his name and says she has to keep saying, I'm a dinner jacket, to herself in order to get the pronunciation right. And I know you're concerned with pronunciation. Is there anything inherent just in that little blip there, or am I making too much of it?
No, I don't think you're making too much of it. I think it's culturally very significant. You hear it in the mispronunciations of Iran, which is almost always called Iran or Iran.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with Iraq. It's called Iraq or Iraq. You don't have to be a speaker of Arabic to be able to pronounce the names of these countries properly, as well as Ahmadinejad. I mean, it's not that difficult to say these things. I think it indicates a certain racism, Western superiority. It doesn't matter. And I'll give you an example why I believe that's true. You notice when they pronounce the names of, let's say, French or German leaders, they don't say Sarkozy, or they don't say Chirac. They say Chirac. They say Sarkozy. They say Merkel and Schröder. So clearly, they have people there. These are million-dollar anchors who have producers, who have language skills, who instruct them on how to pronounce these words. They can't, almost 5 years into the attack on Iraq and 6 years into the attack on Afghanistan, they still can't get the names of these countries straight.
Well, if I had the president of Turkmenistan's name in front of me, I could pronounce it, but a couple of things strike me there. He has a name which actually is pronounceable. Do you remember
Is it Nazarbayev?
No, he has died. Now it's I can't remember what his name is. Let's not both of us struggle along here.
Let's not embarrass ourselves.
Yes, but it's a long name and it's pronounceable if you look at it and if you want to pronounce it correctly. But he of the late dictator of Turkmenistan and the current one run a country that makes Iran look like Canada. in terms of freedom and what have you. And yet, I don't know if you...
Compare Iran to Saudi Arabia. Don't go to Central Asia.
There you go. There you go. Yeah,
go to a major U.S. ally that is constantly described in the corporate media and by the White House and the Pentagon as a moderate state, as a state that has, you know, some kind of liberal traditions. This is the most misogynist, homophobic, racist, fundamentalist regime on the face of the earth. Nevertheless, the media and the White House and the Pentagon, without any sense of self-reflection or awareness, can call Saudi Arabia moderate.
Mm-hmm. Well, the same with Turkmenistan. Yeah, he came into Washington almost the same day that President Ahmadinejad was in New York, and he was being courted by Secretary of State Rice. Of course, he is willing to start cutting deals with the United States around oil and natural gas. Wherein lies it all, correct?
Well, I think the importance here is the scale. Saudi Arabia has tremendous influence in the Middle East and over U.S. foreign policy because of its command of oil and natural gas and the billions of dollars in surpluses that make all of the, you know, European countries as well as the United States salivate. So I don't think they're really comparable. I think Saudi Arabia is now funding the Sunni jihad, the Wahhabi-driven jihad in not only Iraq, which is well-documented, but also in Lebanon and in other countries as well. Don't forget, this is the regime in Riyadh that got the mujahideen going with billions of dollars of their largesse in Afghanistan. And this mujahideen turned into the Taliban and later parts of them into al-Qaeda.
Well, let's talk a little more about your book. My guest is David Barsamian. His brand new book from City Lights Books, which is citylights.com, is targeting Iran. And you can answer this in your answer to me as well. You may have been a little unkind to me too about people's pronunciation, because sometimes it is hard. But the book, as well as essays, an essay by you, is Noam Chomsky, Ervan Abrahamian.
Abraham,
I almost got it. And Nahid Nosafari.
Yes, she's a brilliant Iranian woman. Her chapter is on contemporary culture in Iran and its flourishing film industry, its literature, its poetic traditions, etc., and the women's movement in Iran. So I'm very glad that she's part of this book because she's touching upon issues which are basically unknown here, that are totally ignored in the media. And Ervan Abrahamian is also Iranian, like Nahid Muzaffari. He's probably the foremost contemporary historian and scholar of modern Iran. And he talks about the internal political structure in Iran, specifically that what I pointed out, that the supreme leader has absolute authority in Iran, and the president is answerable to him. And he also talks about what's happening inside the country politically, but also, you know, Iranian relations vis-a-vis the U.S. And the Chomsky chapter is primarily on U.S. Foreign policy vis-a-vis Iran, you know, beginning with the seminal coup that takes place in 1953, Dwight David Eisenhower, then U.S. President, directed the CIA under Allen Dulles to overthrow the popularly elected democratic government of Mohammad Mossadegh and brought back the Shah to power in Iran.
The secular government of Mossadegh. Right.
Indeed, very popular, democratic. This crushed democracy in Iran and made the Islamic Revolution of 1978-79 inevitable, because all of the secular leadership was wiped out during the coup, and then when the Shah came into power, he destroyed the labor unions, the left, the communists, you know, all kinds of dissent were crushed in Iran under the Shah, except for religious dissent. The one area that he didn't dare touch was the mosque. And it was in the mosques that the people were organizing against him.
Now, you're not making the argument that Iranian society is not repressive.
It's an extraordinary Iranian society, the Iranian government is highly repressive. It is extremely discriminatory. It's racist. It discriminates against the Baha'is, which is a minority religion. It does protect other minorities, by the way. There's a Jewish member of parliament in Iran. There's an Armenian members of parliament. Armenians are Christians, of course, and other minorities, Assyrians, that are protected. But the regime is highly repressive. There is censorship. There is, you know, women are picked up off the street if they're not, you know, dressed properly, if they're not adhering to the Islamic code. No one is positing the Iranian regime in any way as some kind of model or paradigm.
Now, it sounds a lot like many of the U.S. allies. So, like, as you said, Saudi Arabia, but also Egypt and certainly some of the Central Asian countries like Turkmenistan and Kazakhstan.
Well, I was in Iran, and I've been in some of those countries you just mentioned. Possibly the internal freedom in Iran is much greater, actually. There's more room to maneuver. When I was in the country, I traveled freely. No one was following me. My phones weren't tapped. I spoke freely to people. I interviewed people. I was being interviewed by Iranian media, and I had no problems whatsoever. Now, this doesn't obtain in every situation. I do know every time there is a ratcheting up of belligerent rhetoric from Washington, there seems to be a direct connection between that and a crackdown on dissidents in Iran. And this touches upon one of the major points in the book in which Shirin Ebadi, who's the Iranian woman who won the 2003 Nobel Prize, she's a very distinguished lawyer, judge, human rights activist, I interviewed her, and she pleaded with me to tell Americans not to attack Iran. This will only solidify support for the regime. She says, I think quite rightly, that democracy cannot be imposed from a B-52. It cannot be delivered, you know, from an F-16. It must be something organic, and there is a democracy movement inside of Iran today. She's one of the major spokespersons for it, but she fears that if there is an attack, that the regime will use it to completely crush all dissidents inside the country. Anyone who criticizes, you know, the actions of the government will be seen as supporting the Americans, who are the imperialist aggressors in, you know, neighboring Iraq, and support Israel and carry out a war in Afghanistan, etc. So I think that's a very, very significant part of this. As we speak, Peter, there are three aircraft carrier battle groups within 200 miles of the Iranian coast in the Persian Gulf. And when I say an aircraft carrier battle group, it doesn't just mean an aircraft carrier. It's destroyers, cruisers, submarines, minesweepers, F-16s, helicopter gunships, and marine battalions. So there are major armadas poised right off the coast of Iran. These are not routine naval maneuvers, as the Pentagon likes to, you know, say. This is the big stick. This is gunboat diplomacy. They're trying to intimidate the Iranians, and I don't think the Iranians are going to back down. And I pose this rhetorical question to you. What if the Iranian Navy, which barely exists, incidentally, they don't have, you know, a single aircraft carrier. What if the Iranian Navy was positioned off the coast of New York or San Francisco? What do you think the response might be from Washington?
Yeah, and what do we think if Iran was fighting a war against Canada and against Mexico and,
exactly.
had troops? David Barsamian is my guest. He's got a brand new book out that, as far as I'm concerned, if you really want to know what is happening and what is in store, required reading. Targeting Iran, it's published by City Lights Books. You can go to citylights.com. Now, David Barsamian is going to be in our city and actually in the area on this coming week. Tuesday, October 9th, he is going to be speaking at the Peace Action Fall Forum. At 3 p.m., he's going to be at Wayne State University at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies. And then in the evening at 7:30 p.m. at the First United Methodist Church, which is on Woodward in Ferndale. Now, if you're driving or something like this, a little hard to get, you can go to my website, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com, and click on the calendar. All that information is there. And David Barsamian, is that information on your site as well?
Yes, it's on alternativeradio.org. I'll also be speaking in Ann Arbor for your listeners that live in the Ann Arbor area on Wednesday in the evening. That's October 10th at the Pittsdale Library.
Now, George Bush and many of the military officers in the Pentagon say that Iran is meddling in Iraq, and that and plus that they're trying to develop nuclear weapons, and hence they represent the evil that was mentioned in that headline, "Evil Has Landed," when President Ahmadinejad came to New York, and Hitler, because of this expansive desire on the part of Iran to be the hegemonic power in the Middle East. That would be the argument.
Well, this is what is being pushed forth in this propaganda offensive, to soften up the American population so that it will back an attack on Iran. I believe, incidentally, that such an attack will have consequences that we could not possibly describe or control. The rivers of blood you see today in Iraq that are flowing will turn into oceans of blood. Iran is not a banana republic. It's a country of 70 million people. It has great history, great traditions, and if there is an attack, I think large numbers of the population will rally around the government. Now, the accusations that are being made by Cheney primarily, and Bush and Rice and the others, I believe are false. Does Iran have interests in Iraq? Of course it does. It's a neighboring country. There are many Iranians living in Iraq. There are many Iraqis living in Iran, for that matter. The two most, and I talk about this in the book, Targeting Iran, the two holiest shrines in all of Shia Islam are located in Iraq. Your Muslim listeners will know this very well. The shrine of Imam Ali, the first imam of Shia Islam, is in Najaf, and the shrine of his son, Imam Hussein, is in Karbala. It is the dream of every Shia Muslim, particularly Iranian Shia Muslims, to make a pilgrimage to those shrines. And many, many millions have gone over the years, and particularly since Saddam Hussein has been overthrown, because he of course, clamped down on the movement of religious pilgrims between Iran and Iraq because of the war and then the war's aftermath. So he made it very difficult for Iranian Shias to perform the pilgrimages to Najaf and to Karbala. So the idea that Iran is meddling, interfering in the internal affairs of Iraq is, I believe, requires a certain hubris and an unconsciousness that I think only Jonathan Swift maybe could write about and do justice.
Well, if you think about the distances involved,
well, the United States has 180,000 troops and 100,000 mercenaries in the country. It has come from 7,000 miles away to invade and occupy Iraq, yet it has the chutzpah to call Iranians interfering into the internal affairs of Iraq.
Meddling.
I mean, this is just... astonishing. Now, much of the Iraqi leadership owes their allegiance to Iran. In fact, I would say owes their very existence to Iran, because Iran protected them during the regime of Saddam Hussein. That includes Jafari, the previous prime minister. It includes the current prime minister, Maliki. It includes Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who's the head of the Supreme Iraqi Islamic Council. All of these, and the Dawah Party, which is the party that Maliki comes from, all of these guys and all of these parties were birthed in Tehran. That's where they were throughout the 1980s and 1990s. So they have very close connections with Iran, and not to mention the fact that most of them are co-religionists. 65% of the population of Iraq is Shia, and 90% of the population of Iran is Shia. So there's that bond as well.
Well, there has been posed the idea that we began this interview with David Barsamian with you, David, making the statement that logic would dictate that there should be no attack on Iran, which I went, uh-oh. But there is a perverse logic, of course, that if the United States was to attack Iran, and they wouldn't invade it, obviously, the troops aren't there, so it would be this one of these shock and awe bombing missions that would do great damage to the infrastructure of that country and take a large civilian casualties, that there would be a strike back by Iran at who knows at what level and who knows in what country, and including this one. Since if we're bombing their country in war, turnabout fair play, but this
no, I disagree with you there. They don't have to come to North America. They have American troops sitting ducks in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in the Persian Gulf. They have missiles that can reach those warships in the Gulf. They have surface-to-surface missiles that can do an enormous amount of damage to the United States. So that's why I said the consequences of opening up this Pandora's box will be enormous. The region will be drenched in blood, and the United States will be there in permanent conflict, further inflaming the Islamic Muslim world, further engendering animosity and hostility toward our country. Because since I just was in Syria and Lebanon and Turkey, and I was in Iran just before that, from the view of many Muslims, now I think it's important that your listeners hear this, whether it's right or wrong, the view of many Muslims, particularly in those countries I just described, is that the United States is waging a war against Islam.
Yeah. Well, the idea, though, that, again, going back to the logic of the Bush administration, is that if there was this conflict that fuels, of course, the military-industrial complex, which we're turning over hundreds of billions of dollars that could be used for a few other things here in this country, and you might make the argument that this would rally people around George Bush, who now is at his administration at an historic low. He's kind of like right below that guy who, remember, was traveling on that plane with tuberculosis. So that's kind of the conspiratorial view, that actually making things worse would act to the benefit of the far right wing.
That's not clear at all. It's hard to ascribe motivations to these people. Clearly, there's a certain product in the ground in those countries, particularly Iraq and Iran, and it's not watermelons or cantaloupes. I'll leave it to your imagination as to what that might be. That certain product animates these people's vision, to use a much cliched and overused word, about the Middle East. They feel as if, in the words of George Kennan, the great liberal, moderate State Department planner, it's our oil.
Yeah.
It happens to be under their ground, under their sand, but it's our oil. And so domination of oil is the single driving factor in the formulation of United States foreign policy, particularly when it comes to the Middle East. If you read the State Department planning documents, and I believe there's one, I do quote one in my introduction, in fact, that in 1945, the oil of the Middle East was called by the State Department as the greatest strategic prize in the history of the world.
Well, then your title of your brand new book, just released by City Lights Books, is apropos, Targeting Iran. David Barsamian, along with other writers, including Noam Chomsky. David Barsamian is going to be in Detroit Tuesday, October 9th at 3 p.m. at Wayne State University at the Center for Peace and Conflict Studies and at the First United Methodist Church in Ferndale at 7:30 p.m. You can go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com. and click on the calendar, or to David's website, alternativeradio.org. David Barsamian, thanks again for joining me on the Peter Werbe Show.
Always a pleasure, Peter. Thank you.
This is WRIN.org.
back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. It's a pleasure to be with you. We've talked a lot about not so much economics, but the impact of economic policy on all of us, how recent events and the policies of the Bush administration has affected mostly the poor. We spoke the other day with Catherine S. Newman, who was the co-author of The Missing Class, Portraits of the Near Poor in America. And normally we talk about people that are suffering the worst in today's times. And the uh-huh comes from my guest, Robert H. Frank, who has written the book Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. That's what I was setting things up for. We're going to talk about those folks, people like me, and I suspect like Professor Frank, who are in the middle class. Robert H. Frank is an economics professor in the Johnson Graduate School of Management at Cornell University. He's a columnist for the New York Times. His books include Winner Take All Society, Luxury Fever, Choosing the Right Pond, Passions Within Reason, and then one that doesn't sound real exciting, Principles of Economics, which is probably one of the reasons they call it the dismal science. But, Robert Frank, welcome to the show. And economics isn't quite the dismal science that it was. Would you agree?
No, I think people's impression of our profession has really started to turn around a little bit. You know, there have been the pop books that have come out in the last few years. But, you know, I think economists have begun to prove that they've got something useful to say about everyday life now.
And the Principles of Economics, tell us about your co-author. This is, I didn't realize this till I looked at the back of your new book, Falling Behind.
A few years ago, Ben Bernanke and I wrote a principles book that is the title given to all the introductory textbooks. And what we thought we could do differently was take out all the chaff that's in most of them. They just throw thousands of concepts at students, and it all seems to go by in a blur. What we tried to do was isolate half a dozen principles and hammer away at them over and over again in the hope that by the end of the term, people would have learned them. And so far, so good. Yeah, I think we're seeing some results.
And Ben S. Bernanke is now the chair of the Federal Reserve System.
That's right. He's gone on to greener pastures, but Someday he'll retire from that and come back to the book. We'll look forward to that day.
Well, Robert Frank, one of the things that makes your book so interesting, it seems, and tell me if I'm correct, that you interweave essentially sociology as well. So it's not just a bunch of curves intersecting and what have you, but we're talking about how policy affects all of us. And in this case, in Falling Behind, how the rising inequality harms the middle class. So I'm sure that's a conscious decision on how you write.
Well, if you think about the problems caused by inequality, you really can't just talk about them in exclusively economic terms. There's a whole variety of dimensions in which inequality affects people in their daily lives. So the book draws on some of the research findings from biology, some from psychology, so sociology, as you mentioned, is in there. Yeah, I think we're becoming a little bit more modest, we economists. I think we used to think everybody needed to learn from us. Now we've begun to realize belatedly that there's a lot of useful ideas in other disciplines, too. And it's really a synthesis that's going to get us to understand what we're trying to figure out.
Is there any difference, or is there an increasing politicization of economics? That is to say that if you are concerned with profit and loss and elements of the economy like that, you tend to be a conservative. If you care about the social impact of economic policy, that somehow makes you a liberal.
You know, if you counted heads, you might see a majority breakout, just as you described there. But, you know, there are many people who are concerned about efficiency who also care deeply about social justice. In fact, one of the main points I've tried to emphasize in my own writings is that if you're not doing things as efficiently as you can, then that means you're missing an opportunity to help the groups you care about.
Well, let's talk a little about your book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class, published by the University of California Press. Now, I've interviewed people like the talk show host, Tom Hartman, who talks about the war on the middle class and that the standard of living is eroding. But you're actually after something a little different, aren't you?
The the middle class has a little bit more money than it did. If by middle class we're talking just for the sake of discussion as the median earner, that the family of four in the middle now earns about $45,000 a year. That's about 15% more than 25 years ago in real purchasing power terms. So you could say, well, what's the problem for the people in the middle? If they've got more money, they shouldn't be complaining. But as I try to explain in Falling Behind, it's not so much how much you have that determines how well off you are. That's the traditional economic model that says that. If you look at your absolute consumption, that's the uniquely sufficient predictor of how well off you are. What we know from a lot of other behavioral science literature is that it's relative income as much as absolute incomes that predict how well people feel they're doing in the world. People ask, how am I doing? How can you answer a question like that without a frame of reference?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in the middle and you've fallen much further behind the people ahead of you, you're not going to be as quick to say, I'm doing okay, as you might have been.
Well, talk to us a little about consumption, because there's certainly more to consume these days. I wonder if that's all kept up with it, because, I mean, now we got to purchase all these little electronic projects or products, and including like cell phones, and we have to pay for what was once free, for, you know, television, and on and on and on. In fact, in many cases, you have to pay for radio these days if you want to get satellite.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's much more to buy, and in fact, to have a standard of living that's adjudged to be middle class, you have to have all these accoutrements, or you're thought odd.
That's right. So if you're living in a place where everyone has a cell phone and people expect you to be reachable at any moment, then not having one isn't just doing without a frill. That's expected of you. In L.A., if you don't have a car, it's very difficult to meet the demands of social existence. I was a Peace Corps volunteer years ago in a rural Nepalese village. You weren't expected to have a car there. You could function quite nicely without one. So, yeah, I think there are many practical ways in which what you need really does depend on what everyone else has.
Well, I'm thought of as an eccentric in many ways. So I don't have a cell phone. And people, well, now they routinely say, well, what's your cell number? I say, I don't have one. And they go, my wife and I don't have cable TV. When we tell people that, they also think that
you're an outlier for sure on both of those dimensions.
But,
you know,
yeah, go ahead.
I was speaking with a friend at the most recent economics convention. He had an appointment with an editor to discuss his book project. And I ran into him later that day and asked him how it had gone. He said, well, the editor never showed up. And I said to him, well, you're in luck. You know, this is a really nice editor. I know this man. And he's going to be so mortified that he missed his appointment with you that he's going to give specially careful consideration to your project. And so he had scheduled a meeting. He was trying to schedule another meeting with him. And I said to him the next day when I ran into him again, what happened? He said he was angry at me for not having gotten the email he'd sent me 90 minutes before the meeting saying that he wasn't going to be able to make it. He expected me to have a BlackBerry or a laptop in this distant city and be reachable at any instant, and he was angry that I wasn't.
All right, Frank, talk to me a little about watches. I was, I've never owned a watch, more eccentricity, I suppose. But a couple of years ago, I was fortunate enough to be able to make, as a journalist, to make a trip to Cuba, and I realized that I probably should have a watch. So I went to a Kmart. And finally found, pardon me, a watch for $7.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 2 years ago. I just happened to look at it the other day. It's still ticking, as they say.
But
then I look in the New York Times, where you're a columnist sometimes. And I'm sorry, tell me, are your columns regularly appearing or at?
Yes, they appear in the Sunday business section every 2 months.
Okay. And yet, when I, particularly around holidays, Father's Day, Christmas, and what have you, the full-page ads for watches that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. Now, my little plastic Kmart watch does the job, but that's not what they're all about, are they?
Well, you know, you say it does the job, Peter. It actually does the job better than the watches costing thousands of dollars in one sense, because those, for the most part, are mechanical watches. They've got intricate gears and all sorts of special features that make them more accurate. But what that means is that they're relatively accurate for a mechanical watch. There are lots of watches out there costing $50,000 and more that are much less accurate than your $8 Timex. So, you know, the watches don't keep particularly good time, but they do send a signal to the world that you're a player if you have one. And there are many men, apparently. I was told this by a clerk at Cartier in New York once, that there are many men who have four or five of these watches costing $30,000 and up.
Phew. Now, I know, as an economist, you're familiar with the books by Thorstein Veblen, who wrote over 100 years ago. Is it in his book? Remind me, I'm just off the top of my head this coming. He wrote a book called The Theory of the Leisure Class.
That's right.
And it was he, wasn't it, who spoke about conspicuous consumption?
Published in 1899, that was the first use of the term, conspicuous consumption. It was his view that people mainly wanted to display their capability by buying fancy things. And, you know, there is a lot of that. I think sometimes people are worried that others will underestimate them if they're wearing a cheap suit or driving a cheap car. So it's not just a matter of showing off. It's wanting not to be dismissed out of hand in some circumstances, but I don't think that's mostly what it is. You know, I think when people get used to a certain standard and they've got plenty of money, as the people at the top of the income ladder do, then it's only natural to reach out and try something new, bigger and better. Even if there were no one else around to impress, you'd get a kick out of the new, better version. So I think it doesn't start out mainly as people trying to impress one another.
Well, let's go back into the subtitle of your book, Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. Now, we're talking about this great rise in wealth that's come about through increased productivity over the last 20 or 30 years. It's mostly gone to the upper 10%, 5%, 1%. But you say that the middle class itself has more available funds for which to buy any host of products. So how are we hurt? How are us middle classers hurt, in your view?
Okay, it's a fair question, and I think the easiest way to sort of see what's been problematic is to focus on the biggest expenditure item of all, which is housing. So, as we were discussing, the people at the top of the income ladder have really gotten the lion's share of the gains. So, CEOs of big companies now earn 500 and sometimes as much as the average worker. As recently as 1980, they earned only 42 times as much. So it's just been a really explosive rate of increase at the top. These people have lots of money. They aren't evil people, most of them. They've earned their money according to the rules. They've made good products. They've been effective decision makers for their firms. But naturally, they spend their money when they have more. That's what you and I do. Well, maybe not you.
No.
That's what most people do, let's say.
Yeah.
And when they spend more, it doesn't cause any consternation at all on the part of the middle class. The middle class, you know, likes to see pictures of the mansions and the yachts. They hope they'll be rich someday. They're not resentful or envious in the least, as far as we can tell. But what we do know, too, is that the people just below the rich are influenced when the rich build bigger. You know, it may not be that the people below are jealous. Maybe it's just a question of the customs. That maybe now it's the custom you have your daughter's wedding reception in your home. Now, it used to be you'd go to a hotel or a club to do that. So if you're in that circle, you need to build bigger. And then once you've built bigger, there are others close to you just below. Maybe now it's the custom in your circle. You have dinner parties for 30, not 24. And so people there need to build bigger, too. And it cascades all the way down the income ladder. And so by the time you get to the median family, the one right in the middle, the new house built, it has a median size now of 2,300 square feet. And that's about 48% more than the median new house built in 1980. And what that means, finally, is that the median family has to spend a whole lot more on a house or else fall way behind community standards on housing expenditures. And if they do that, then their kids go to bad schools. That's the long chain of effects that results in some pain for the middle class if they don't keep up.
Well, you know, when I was a lot younger, you notice I didn't say young. When I was a lot younger, I always spoke, you know, but that we all lived kind of like hippies and what have you. But then as people in my generation, as in yours and ours, began moving into positions within the middle class, certainly our income increased. And sometimes people say, oh, man, you're selling out, you know, because you're picking up those middle class accoutrements, and including a house in the suburbs and what have you. But I always said that everyone, I said that it's really wrong to make those kind of ethical judgments. All of us consume to the available income that we have. And so if you're, as you said, if you're making more, well, you're going to consume more. But that actually doesn't have an absolute ceiling like that at all, does it? Because what we have is a middle class, and that's probably one of the reasons, or one of the reasons you talk about in Falling Behind, about how rising inequality harms the middle class, is that so many people in the middle class are financing consumption through debt.
That's right. So yeah, if your goal is to send your children to a school of at least average quality, and what parent wouldn't have at least that ambition in life, and if the median house now has gotten much more expensive, you're going to figure out some way to get into that house. If it means working longer hours, you'll do that. People are working longer hours. If it means buying someplace further out and commuting longer distance to save money, you'll do that. If it means taking on more debt, you'll do that. If it means not having any savings for retirement, we've seen people go that route too. So it's just really been a question of working every available margin to try to keep up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's put people spending beyond their means. It's quite common now to see families carrying $9,000 is the average credit card debt for a family with one card, at least. We see much higher debts than that. It's not a good situation to be trying to pay your bills when the standard you have to meet is so much more difficult.
Yeah. I've never really read who I mentioned earlier, Thorstein Veblen, but I have read Marshall Solons, who particularly his book, Stone Age Economics, which I've always been fascinated by. And I'm just paraphrasing but his first chapter in his book, which was called The First Affluent Society, where he talks about desires becoming necessities.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's part of the process of bidding up what is what was once just a something that was of interest, but now you really can't be thought of as a successful member of society unless you have all this stuff.
You know, this is not a new thing either. Adam Smith wrote about this in The Wealth of Nations. He talked about a lowly day laborer. Even the one with the lowest pay in all of Scotland couldn't appear in public without shame unless he had a linen shirt, Smith wrote. Hmm. And he noted that the Greeks and the Romans, even the wealthiest ones, didn't have linen shirts, and that was no problem. But, you know, in his day, if you couldn't afford a linen shirt, that meant you somehow had not played by the rules. You just were not a functioning member of society. So, yeah, it's definitely clear that the standards you have to meet do depend on what others are spending, and those escalate over time, and it makes it harder if your income's not growing as fast.
Now, linen shirt is an external garment. Your publicist insisted that I ask you about an undergarment that is for sale at Victoria's Secret, which is what, $1 million bra?
Well, that was the first of a series of bejeweled bras that they offered in their Christmas catalog. It appeared in 1996, the first one. It had diamonds sewn into it. It was modeled by Claudia Schiffer. It was on offer for $1 million. And then they followed that year by year with one ever more elaborate and expensive. So the next year it was $3 million. The most expensive one so far was modeled by Gisele Bündchen, the $30 million a year Brazilian supermodel, and it was on offer for $12.5 million. You know, no one's ever bought one of these bras, I learned.
Their function is then?
Their function, it seems. Well, the media cover them every year at Christmas time. There's usually some print and electronic coverage of the unveiling of the new spectacular bejeweled bra. But I think more than that, if you see it in the catalog and you think to yourself, well, somebody's spending $12.5 million for his special someone, maybe it's not so unreasonable to spend $300 for my special someone. You know, it just shifts your frame of reference in a subtle way.
Robert Frank is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. The book is Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. It's available from the University of California Press. And I'll give you Robert Frank's website address just in a few minutes at the end of our interview. So much of what we've talked about, and if this is the case, I bear responsibility, has been mostly just the quirks of the human personality. But we're talking about how rising inequality harms the middle class, because if there's an increased rat race, that has effects. But normally we assign that to a person's own responsibility. If they would just kind of calm down a little, consume a little less, everything would be okay. But what are actually the overall social, and you even indicate physical harm that inequality creates?
Yeah, if I think you can ask someone if it's just a question of buying a designer handbag or shoes from a famous manufacturer, you can't ask somebody to hold off on that. That's not an essential for leading a successful life. But you can't really ask somebody not to meet community standards when it comes to buying a gift for your best friend's daughter's wedding. You know, the spending on gifts has gone up a lot, led primarily by the increased spending at the top. You shouldn't ask somebody to skimp on an interview suit. You know, we know that the people who are dressed the best in an interview are more likely to get the callback. You can't ask somebody to cut back on spending on a house in a decent school district. So really, that's all someone can control is the amount he or she spends. He can't control what others spend. And in those situations where you're really expected to meet a certain standard, you don't have much latitude for individual action. And if you can't meet the standard, as you note, it's stressful. You know, there are very persuasive studies now showing that health and well-being suffer enormously when people feel that they're in a subordinate position and unable to meet their basic responsibilities. You get sick more often, you die at a younger age. There's even some disturbing evidence showing that in higher inequality areas, homicide rates are higher.
Huh.
I don't know if you saw Michael Moore's film Bowling for Columbine.
I did.
He goes on and on looking for explanations for why Canadians who have just as many guns as Americans do don't kill each other with guns very often. In fact, only about 1/100th of the homicide rate there as we have. And he's talking about the culture of fear here. He shows newscasters leading the 10 o'clock news with reports of a rattlesnake being found in somebody's room and all the bodies carried out at the end of the day. So it's that culture of fear he identifies. There are now studies showing that it's just inequality difference between Canada and the U.S. If you look at a graph of homicide versus inequality by states in Canada, provinces in Canada and states in the U.S., they all line up on a nice upward sloping straight line. The higher the inequality, the higher the homicide rate. All the Canadian provinces are down near the origin. They don't have very high homicide or high inequality, but the higher inequality provinces there do have higher homicide rates. And then there are the U.S. states all on top of them. The higher the inequality, the higher the homicide rate.
Can we, and what a tall order, in about 60 seconds, talk about how do we deal, how do we unwind inequality?
You know, I always tell students it's good to get angry sometimes, but you got to make sure you get angry at the right people. I think we're foolish to wag our fingers at the people at the top for spending a lot. That's just what people do when they have a lot. What's really the only lever we have, if you're talking about trying to attenuate some of the pain of inequality, is the tax system. Most countries have about as much pre-tax inequality as we do, but they use their tax system to make the after-tax distribution of incomes and services much less unequal than it is in the United States. And I think we've got to ask, why are we giving tax cuts to the people who've been experiencing the biggest income gains all along? That's what no other country does. Why aren't we increasing social services? There's a strong sentiment now to have universal health care. The auto companies in Detroit would be a lot more competitive if they didn't have to shoulder the burden of an inefficient healthcare system. Yeah, I think we really need to look to public policy if we want to do something about this.
Well, Robert H. Frank, I want to thank you so much for being with me. The book is Falling Behind, How Rising Inequality Harms the Middle Class. You can go to Professor Frank's website. It's robert-h-frank.com. And I'll have a link on my website, peterwerby.com. Robert Frank, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Peter, thanks so much for having me on.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
Radio. Oh, wouldn't it be grand to gather round?